the limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized and made to seem either to be communist or some sort of disloyal person. They've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. Who, you know, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only way.
This week in radical history for the week starting January 12th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for January 12th. New World Shenanigans in 1641 in Jamestown, Virginia, passes a law that if any Indian commits a crime, the first Indian apprehended must pay the penalty, even if it's with his life. Also for January 12th, anarchist Anglo-American sculptor Sir Jacob Epstein lives on this date in 1880, most known for his creation of the sculpture in the tomb of Oscar Wilde in Paris. More American indigenous news on this date in Florida in 1833, they passed an act making it unlawful for any Indian to remain within the boundaries of the state. Also on January 12, 1928, police seize 800 copies of the lesbian novel The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall. Both the UK and then the United States governments treat this first well-known English book on lesbian and life and struggles as pornography. In the land of the free at that time, the Great Seal of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice depicts a book-burning event. Also on this date in 1933 in Spain, the anarchist uprising, which began on the 8th of January, is brutally suppressed. The greatest success of the movement happened in Andalusia. Police and army buildings were attacked, and anarcho-trade unionists seize public buildings and proclaim libertarian communism there. As government forces sweep the area, in a small village of Casas Vajas, the government demonstrate their cruelty by assassinating many in the villages, burning alive all gathered in a thatched cottage. Also on January 12, 1940 in Canada, during this month, Emma Goldman's mail is intercepted by government censors, their suspicion raised by many of the letters containing money pouring into her address for the defense of anarchist Arthur Bortolotti, whose case attracts further attention in the U.S. through articles in The Nation and The New Republic. As Goldman raised bail money for him, he is now charged with immigration violation rather than breach of War Measures Act. By mid-January, Goldman returns to raising funds for the Spanish anarchists.
How many roads must a man walk down before he calls any man?
On a state in 1963, Bob Dylan sings Blowing in the Wind on BBC radio presentation of the Madhouse on Cattle Street. The song became a classic with 1960s protest movement.
How many times must the cannibals fly before they forever fail? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
On January 12, 1968, USA and Cambodia announced an agreement designed to insulate Cambodia from the war at Vietnam. Not to fear, Tricky Dick Nixon and Henry Hank will, with a rain of bombs and secret illegal invasions, set the stage for massive Cambodia destabilization and more killing fields. Also on a state in 1971 in England, the home of Robert Carr, MP, is bombed after he introduces an industrial relations bill in a drive to crush trade unionism. This and many other bombings is attributed to the Angry Brigade.
The United States Congress voted on this day in 1991 to authorize the use of military force in Kuwait to repel the Iraqi invasion there. Kuwait had been stealing oil from under Iraqi soil by drilling diagonally using specialized slant drilling equipment manufactured by a U.S. company, and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's appeals to the United States to pressure Kuwait to desist went unheeded. Hussein threatened to invade Kuwait and received a neutral response from the United States. By the time Iraqi troops crossed the border, Kuwait had been largely evacuated, and Iraq captured the country with minimal bloodshed. A carefully concocted public relations campaign launched by the PR firm Hill & Knowlton employed the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to deliver testimony before Congress that she had witnessed Iraqi soldiers removing babies from incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital. Although that testimony was later revealed to have been a complete fabrication, it had an effect on Congress, which voted to send U.S. troops to Kuwait. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, January 12th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Enid Quinn.
Thanks to the Neighborhood Network of Columbus for all the great audio I use for this show. This week in Radical History for January 13th. In 1099 in Syria, the God-loving Crusaders set fire to Mara and slaughtered 3,000 Muslim captives, all for Jesus.
Did you ever notice how in the Bible, whenever God needed to punish someone or make an example, or whenever God needed a killing, he sent an angel? Did you ever wonder what a creature like that must be like? A whole existence spent praising your God, but always with one wing dipped in blood.
More God news on January 13th. In 1777, Jefferson gets Virginia to make sodomy punishable by castration.
Dipped in blood, dipped in blood, dipped in blood, praising your God, dipped in blood.
Also on this date in 1874, the first Thompson Square police riot and massacre occurs. As unemployed workers demonstrate in New York City's Thompson Square Park, mounted police officers charge into the crowd, indiscriminately clubbing adults and children, leaving hundreds of casualties. The New York police commissioner boasts, "It was the most glorious sight I've ever seen. Those with jobs face wage cuts, while the jobless go hungry." In the winter of 1873, 900 people starved to death, and 3,000 deserted their infants on doorsteps in New York alone. Only a couple more items for January 13th, 1909. Anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman lectures on the dissolution of our institutions in San Francisco. Buwalda, a military man, was court-martialed for attending one of Emma Goldman's meetings. The evidence presented at his trial was that he was seen shaking hands with her. Also in 1929, Wyatt Earp, a noted scoundrel, crook, and U.S. Marshal, dies at age 80. Lastly, on this date in 1979, the YMCA files a lawsuit against the Village People over the song YMCA. The suit would later be dropped. This week in Radical History for January 14th. 1892, Martin Niemöller, pacifist pasture, is born in Germany. He famously coined these words: "In Germany they came first for the communist, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I'm not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time no one was left to speak up. And when will they come for you?" In 1963, George Wallace is sworn in as governor of Alabama. In his address to the state, he says, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." Also on this date in 1970, anarchist pacifist Amon Anansi dies, best known for his work in operating the Joe Hill Hospitality House for transients in Salt Lake City, Utah. Influenced Dorothy Day and Utah Phillips, Hennessy was a self-described Christian anarchist pacifist who never paid taxes and refused to be drafted into any war. Also on January 14, 1981, President Jimmy Carter authorizes sending combat equipment to El Salvadorian junta, just another democratic gesture of free-loving people. Also on this date in 1996, 16 protesters arrested at the winter blockade at a rural Wisconsin site for the U.S. Navy's ELF transmitter, which transmitting targeted signals to nuclear weapons aboard U.S. submarines. A total of nearly 400 arrests have occurred in 24 actions in the last 5 years at the ELF Navy site. Lastly, for January 14, 2005, Army Specialist Charles Garner Jr., ringleader of the band of rogue guards at Abu Ghraib prison, convicted at Fort Hood, Texas, for abusing Iraqi detainees. Scapegoated to protect higher-ups in the Bush administration torture policies, he'd later be sentenced to 10 years in prison. Bush officials in jail for torture? That would be zero. This week in Radical History for January 15th, more Christian beliefs. In 1757, the Archbishopric of Cologne approves a schedule of fees victims of torture must pay, up to 5 talents for being quartered by horses, for example.
Praising your God dipped in blood.
Also on January 15th, 1809 in France, Paris-Joseph Proudhon is born. Famous philosopher, economist, socialist, often referred to as the father of modern anarchism. Of anarchy, he once said, "Property is theft, anarchy is order. Whoever puts his hand on me to govern me is a usurper and a tyrant. I declare him my enemy." Also on this date in 1877, Standing Bear, a Ponchatouche chief, refuses to move the reservation because it is within the lands already given to Lakota. When they learned they were going to be moved to the Indian Territories in 1876, they sent 10 chiefs to the United States agent to look over the land and its prospects. They were to make the decision for the tribe. Based on what they learned, the chiefs could not make a favorable report. The tribe voted not to go to Indian Territory. The government then forced the tribe into Indian Territory without their consent. The tribe arrived in Oklahoma Territory too late to plant crops, and they were not prepared for winter, causing many deaths, including the death of Standing Bear's son. More land of the free. Also on this date in 1929, American civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. lived in Atlanta, Georgia. Also in 1968, the Jeanette Rankin Brigade. Led by 87-year-old Rankin, the first U.S. Congresswoman and only member of Congress to vote against U.S. entry into both world wars, marches on Washington to protest war in Vietnam. At the opening of this year's Congress, the coalition of women's peace groups called the Jeanette Rankin Brigade demonstrate against the Vietnam War. The New York Radical Women stage a burial of traditional womanhood, and this was the first use of the phrase, sisterhood is powerful. More colonial news in 1981, El Salvador. The American support of Salvadorian government disappears 8 staff members of the El Independent. Lastly, in a state in 1991, President Bush restores $42.5 million in military aid to El Salvador. 15 children under 14 who had been detained, charged with terrorism, were found decapitated. 13,500 civilians murdered or disappeared in 8 months, and the Army no longer bothers to use prisons. This week in Radical History for January 16, 1893 in Hawaii. The Hawaiian Queen's regime is overthrown by U.S. pineapple tycoon Sanford and Doyle and pro-annexation sugar interests. With an amazing sense of timing, U.S. troops just happened to land to protect American interests. With support from U.S. Minister John Stevens, Dole declares himself Hawaiian president and lobbies for U.S. annexation. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee recommends annexation, declaring it, quote, a duty that has its origin in the noblest sentiments that inspire the love of the father for his children. And the rest is history. Also on this date in 1916, Emma Goldman gives a lecture at the Masonic Temple in New York City on the child's right not to be born. According to the New York Times, Emma said that if everyone followed the injunction of the Bible and Theodore Roosevelt to be fruitful and multiply, every tenement house would be turned into a lunatic asylum. More news you never read in textbooks. In 1920 in Russia, the Allied powers recognize the independence of Russia, Georgia. The blockade of USSR is raised. Few Americans know that the U.S. was part of the invading and occupying forces of Russia during this period. Just more of what they don't bother to teach you in schools. Lastly, for January 16, 1984, Paul and Linda McCarthy is arrested in Barbados for possession of marijuana. Since Clinton came into office, the number of marijuana arrests has not only nearly doubled, but is also greater than the entire population of Chicago. The federal snitch program offers rewards for the guilty and punishes the less guilty, with minor offenders given sentences ranging from 5 years to life without parole when dealers snitch on one another to avoid going to jail to reduce their sentences. The snitch program allows any person to be convicted without physical evidence, solely on the testimony of one individual, i.e. the drug dealer, without corroboration. Since the U.S. drug war has been proclaimed, the percentage of major dealers sentenced to prison remains under 10% of all drug-related convictions. This week in Radical History for January 17th, I only have 3 items. 1863 in Colorado, Apache chief agrees to peace talks, is then arrested and imprisoned at Fort McLean, Arizona, then shot by 2 soldiers in his cell. Also on January 17th in 1915, anarchist Lucy Parsons leads a hunger march in Chicago. IWW songwriter Ralph Chaplin writes his famous labor song, Solidarity Forever, for the march. Last on this date, 1961, President Eisenhower delivers his farewell address warning the nation of the military-industrial complex and its acquisitions of unwanted influence. What few know is that Eisenhower's original notes mentions the triad of military, industrial, and congressional complex, but he felt including Congress in a lineup would be too much to bite off. This week in Radical History for January 18, 1863, soldiers of the California Volunteers torture and shoot Magus, Colorado, Apache chief, in what has become New Mexico. Magus approached a white army camp seeking a settlement to the war between the United States and the Apaches. He was assured that the camp would enforce the truce. After his warriors leave, however, whites take Magus prisoner and shoot him. Then his soldiers take a scalp, others cut off his head and boil his flesh and dump the headless body into a ditch. The official military report claims Magus was killed while attempting to escape. After learning of Magus' death, Apache chiefs lead their warriors in a guerrilla warfare against whites in the Southwest. And that is how the West was won. Just 3 more items for this week in Radical History. 1911, Japan. The cry of Musifu Shirogi Banzai, long live anarchy, resounds in the Japanese courtroom, shouted by Kanu Suga, one of 26 defendants in the high treason case. This is in response to the death of the hanging verdict of 24 of them. The other anarchists received prison terms of 8 to 11 years. In 1962 Vietnam, U.S. began spraying foliage to reveal Viet Cong guerrillas. Chemicals like Agent Orange would not only cause widespread birth defects in Vietnam, but also U.S. soldiers handling such materials. Lastly, in 2002, U.S. flies 6 terror suspects from Bosnia to custody in Cuba after Bosnian Supreme Court orders them released for lack of evidence. That is justice, Texas style.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I have many friends. And some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were 3 of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. This program can be found each and every Monday at the RadioForAll.net website. A reminder that you can find other great anarcho programming there as well, such as the following.
This is Noam Chomsky speaking on Anarchy Now, putting the rad into radio.
So this program, Anarchy Now, and other amazing works all can be found at the RadioForAll.net website. Inspiration for This Week in Radical History came from the Slingshot Organizer. Get your new 2009 calendar organizer at your local radical establishments.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media, which is why it is so important that we broadcast that voice each and every week. Israel continues to be obsessed by the success of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Israel is trying to legislate against it at both the state and federal level, and is now attempting to prevent its proponents from entering Israel, which includes the Palestinian territories. The following account is from Mondo Weiss. The Israeli government has published its BDS blacklist, which would prevent entry to Israel, known for months to be in the works. It includes 20 organizations that support the Palestinian-led Nonviolent Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, resistance movement against the occupation, including U.S.-based organizations American Muslims for Palestine, Code Pink, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and Jewish Voice for Peace. Strategic Affairs Minister Gilad Erdan, who played a critical role in compiling the blacklist, touted it as a strategic change in the way Israel handles BDS. "We have shifted from defense to offense," Erdan said. The boycott organizations need to know that the state of Israel will act against them and not allow them to enter its territory to harm its citizens. The other blacklisted U.S. organizations are National Students for Justice in Palestine and the American Friends Service Committee, as well as 11 European organizations and three more based in South Africa and South America. Leaders and members of the blacklisted organizations view it as an official implementation of Israel's long-followed unofficial policy of turning away Palestinian human rights activists at its border. Omar Barghouti, a founder of the BDS movement, said in a press release that Israel's new McCarthyism is reaching a new low. By waging an all-out war on the peaceful BDS movement for Palestine rights, and by now banning international human rights organizations and advocates from entry, Israel's desperate and brutal attempts to weaken support for BDS are already backfiring. In an interview with Plus 972 magazine, Jewish Voice for Peace executive director Rebecca Vilcomerson noted that Israel's decision to specifically ban JVP leaders from entry is disconcerting but not surprising, given the consistent erosion of democratic norms as well as increasing fear of the BDS movement in Israel. To Vilcomerson, the blacklist is not only an organizational hardship, but a personal one. The Brooklyn activist is married to an Israeli and has extensive family and friends in Israel and the West Bank, whom she will likely no longer be able to visit. But the barring of Jewish Voice for Peace, an explicitly Jewish organization, suggests a true ideological contradiction forming between Israel's claim as a homeland for all Jews and Israel's fear of the catalyzing BDS movement. And it further reveals the fissures within the mainstream American Jewish communities regarding Israel. Among the 20 blacklisted organizations, there was an overwhelming sense of momentum, an affirmation that BDS is successfully putting pressure on Israel to end its abuse of Palestinians. This blacklist is a declaration of failure and defeat by the State of Israel as it grows out of the global BDS movement. Dr. Osama Abu Irshad, National Policy Director at American Muslims for Palestine, told Mondawise. Israel failed in confronting this movement, which is a non-violent movement for Palestinian rights, and the only way for Israel to deal with this is to repress the activists who are fighting for Palestinian rights in a non-violent way, as it represses the Palestinians in a violent way within the borders of occupied Palestine, Abu Irshad added. It is unclear exactly how or if the ban will inhibit the work of the blacklisted organizations, many of which already work primarily inside the United States. But Ariel Gold of Code Pink noted that the BDS blacklist could have the effect of keeping those of us that work really hard for Palestinian rights as disconnected as possible to the people struggling on the ground. The blacklist would almost certainly prevent Gold and other members of Code Pink, an organization particularly active in protests alongside Palestinians in places such as Nabi Saleh or Hebron in the occupied West Bank, from entry into Israel. It will keep us from being able to see with our own eyes and keep us from being able to participate with our own bodies, Gold told Mondawise. But Gold recognized the absurdity and desperation in this move and is confident many others will as well. She explained to me that as a Jew, it is fair for her to challenge everything, even the very concept of God. But to Israel, the only thing immune to challenge is the validity of a Jewish state. Israel is willing to do anything, even give up their image, which was already a false image, of being a democratic state and being a homeland for all Jews, in order to try and prevent the inevitable, Gold said. This BDS ban really only strengthens the movement further. It allows the rest of the world to see the hypocrisy that Israel is even more clearly. At the news that the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights was included in the blacklist, Executive Director Youssef Munayer wrote the following in a defiant letter to supporters. We wear this designation as a badge of honor. When Israel, which aims to portray itself to the world as liberal and democratic, blacklists activists dedicated to nonviolent organizing and dissent, it only further exposes itself as a fraud. It is clear to us how effective building the movement for Palestinian rights around the world has become. Our commitment to the rights of Palestinians and our demand to hold Israel account for the denial of these rights is unwavering. As in the effort against apartheid in South Africa, the blacklist and repressive efforts like it will be mere footnotes in the historic march toward freedom, justice, and equality. Okay, that was an article from the Mondelweiss News Service. And BDS marches on. Our featured presentation this week is a recent speech delivered at the United Nations by Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi on the impact of the Balfour Declaration on the Palestinian people. It is presented to a UN committee to advance the rights of the Palestinian people. We are including the entire introduction of the speech by its committee chair, Jerry, from South Africa.
A very good afternoon to you all. It's a pleasure to be here with you. My name is Jerry from South Africa. Today I represent, and I've been asked by the United Nations Committee on the Exercise of the Annual Rights of Palestinian People to take care of the proceedings. I have an honor of welcoming you to today's lecture by Professor Rashid Khalidi on the impact of the Balfour Declaration has had on the Palestinian people. Today's lecture will be broadcast live, so you have to smile all the time. When I say this, you smile. And simultaneously, interpretation will be provided to the extent possible in English and Arabic. Our committee is a subsidiary body of the United Nations General Assembly with a mandate to advance and advocate for the rights of Palestinian people, including their right to self-determination in accordance with international law and the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. Our committee is comprised of 50 members, member states from all the regions of the world, and plays a critical role in mobilizing international support for a peaceful settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Ladies and gentlemen, as we know, 2017 marked the 50th year of the Israeli occupation, which began in 1967, and the 70th anniversary of the United Nations resolution to partition Palestine. But it also marks the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. 100 years ago, today, through the darkest days of World War I, the government of the United Kingdom announced its support for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. A letter sent from the UK Foreign Secretary Alfred Balfour to one of the British most distinguished Jewish citizens and Zionist at the time, Baron Rothschild, changed the course of history of the region forever until now. While Israel has been established according to that partition as a national home for the Jewish people, Palestinians remains in limbo without a sovereign state of their own, and with the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, a small fraction of what constituted Palestine in 1947. Under the continued Israeli occupation, and in view of all of us, including the United Nations, some will argue that the Balfour Declaration was harbinger for future injustices, conflict, and more unfulfilled promises, such as the 1947 partition plan and Oslo agreements and all other subsequent agreements. Today's lecture gives us an opportunity to hear about the profound impact of this declaration has had on Palestinian people from a renowned scholar in the modern Middle East and a member of a prominent Jerusalem family whose representatives have distinguished themselves in the whole walks of life of Palestinian life. Professor Khalidi is an eminent scholar whose research primarily covers the history of the modern Middle East, with a particular focus on ways in which external powers have shaped development and conflict in that area. In his book, I quote, "Palestinian Identity, the Construction of Modern National Consciousness," published in 1997, one of his signature works, Professor Khalidi argues that Arabs living in Palestine began to regard themselves as a distinct people decades before 1948 partition and the Nakba, or the catastrophe ending in the flight or expulsion of 50% of Arab populations in Palestine from their homes and from their lands. His scholarship provides a cogent rejoinder to Israel's nationalistic narrative that Arabs in Palestine had no collective identity prior to the 1945's creation of Israel. Professor Khalidi has published widely and won numerous awards, including a top honor of the Middle East Studies Association of North America, the Alpha Haruri Book Award for writing the best book in 1997. In addition to teaching and writing, Professor Khalidi was an advisor to Palestinian negotiations team in the early 1990s. Professor Khalidi is uniquely positioned to address today's subject. It is a privilege to have you here today, sir. Thank you for taking time at your busy and hectic schedule to deliver today's lecture. We really appreciate it. Now, it's my honor, on your behalf to invite Professor Khaledi to deliver his lecture. Afterwards, we will take some few questions. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Your Excellency, for that generous introduction. It's a great honor to be asked to speak here at the United Nations on the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. I'm grateful to His Excellency Ambassador Fodé-Sek of Senegal, to Ambassador Jerry of South Africa, our chair today, to the entire Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, and to the dedicated staff of the UN Secretariat for making this event possible. I think it's particularly fitting to be speaking today at the United Nations, which has played such a large role in the tragedy of Palestine. Today, I am going to take you on a short historical journey in which I will address the impact on the Palestinian people of the Balfour Declaration and of the League of Nations mandate that was based on that declaration. I can only hope that if we can all become more aware of this historical background, we, the world community, and the United Nations in particular, may be able to address the harm that was caused by this declaration to the Palestinians and by all that followed in a more fair and a more effective fashion than it has done over the past 70 years. Now, the momentous statement made on behalf of the British Cabinet on November 2, 1917, by Arthur James Balfour, who was His Majesty's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, is usually looked at in terms of British imperial interests, or in terms of its ostensible subject, a, quote, national home for the Jewish people. We know a great deal about Britain's commitment to Zionism. We know less about what the support of the British Empire via this declaration meant for the aims of Zionism and the Zionist movement, which for nearly half a century proudly described itself as a colonial endeavor, and which at the same time was a national movement in the making. The ultimate objective of political Zionism, as it was laid out by its founder, Theodor Herzl, in his 1896 booklet, Der Judenstaat, was as far-reaching as it was crystal clear. And these aims were never really deviated from. These aims were establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. That's what the title of the book says, meaning, again, the book stresses this, Jewish sovereignty and control of immigration into the country. Whatever Britain may have intended by the Balfour Declaration, complete and exclusive control over the entirety of Palestine was what the Zionist movement consistently fought for during the ensuing half century and eventually obtained. It did so largely as a result of over two decades of unstinting British support secured via this declaration and via the League of Nations mandate that was based upon the declaration. Now, much of this is well known. However, what I want to talk about today is another aspect of this declaration that is of paramount, that I think is of paramount importance, and that is often ignored. This was the perspective of the people of Palestine, whose future the Balfour Declaration ultimately decided. For the Palestinians, this declaration, this statement, was a gun pointed directly at their heads, particularly in view of the colonialist ambiance of the early 20th century. As I will try to show this afternoon, the Balfour Declaration, in effect, constituted a declaration of war by the British Empire on the indigenous population of the land it was promising to the Jewish people as a national home. This declaration launched what has become a century-long assault on the Palestinian people aimed at implanting and fostering this national home at their expense. Now, some people have argued that Zionism can only be seen as a national movement. Others have argued it's a colonial settler movement. I would argue that one can walk and chew gum at the same time, and that from its inception, Zionism was both a nascent national movement and a colonial enterprise in search of a metropolitan sponsor. After having failed to find that sponsor elsewhere, Chaim Weizmann, the second leader of the Zionist movement after Theodor Herzl, succeeded with the wartime British cabinet. The Zionist movement thereafter had the support of the greatest power of the age, Great Britain, which was about to become one of the victors in World War I. Now, Zionism had been viewed with concern in Palestine as early as the late 19th century. But the Balfour Declaration, when it was finally revealed to Palestinians, meant that their country was now threatened by a far greater danger than they had earlier suspected. Indeed, at the very moment that the Balfour Declaration was issued, British troops were advancing northward through Palestine in pursuit of the retreating Ottoman army, and only 5 weeks after the declaration was issued, British forces entered Jerusalem, December 9th, 1917. The text of the declaration confirmed the nature of this danger. It consisted of a single paragraph of 67 words. I'm going to impose on your patience by reading it to you. 67 words. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That is the entirety of the Balfour Declaration issued, as we've just heard, to Lord Rothschild, the leader of the Zionist movement. Now, Palestine was an inhabited country in 1917. 94% of its population was Arab. This overwhelming Arab majority in the country that was the object of the Balfour Declaration went unmentioned by his lordship, except in a backhanded way, as the, quote, existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. They were not described as a people. The words Palestinian and Arab do not appear in the text of the declaration. For all intents and purposes, as a national entity, for Lord Balfour, for the British cabinet, they did not exist. They were existing non-Jewish communities and no more. Furthermore, this is extremely important. They were offered only, quote, civil and religious rights. They were not offered political rights. They were not offered national rights. They were not offered representation. They were not described as a people. They were not told that they would have a national home. All of those things applied to the Jewish people, but not to the indigenous majority in Palestine. By way of contrast, Lord Balfour ascribed national rights to the Jewish people, who in 1917 were represented in Palestine by about 6% of the total population. Regarded in this way, Britain's backing for Herzl's aims of Jewish statehood, sovereignty, and control over immigration into Palestine had portentous implications. It meant British support for bringing into Palestine and implanting a foreign majority at the expense of the indigenous population's rights, and ultimately at the expense of its existence as a people in its own land. The Balfour Declaration thus meant that the Palestinians faced the prospect of being outnumbered by unlimited immigration and of losing control of their country to the Zionist drive for sole sovereignty over a country that was then almost completely Arab in population and culture. It took over 3 decades, and the mass expulsion of a little over half of the Arab population of Palestine from their homes in 1948 for these things to happen, but happen they did. Now, I've mentioned that even before World War I, there had been trepidation among the Arabs of Palestine about the rapid progress of the Zionist movement. This became a widespread sentiment as the movement grew in strength and as immigration to Palestine increased. Between 1909 and 1914, the two leading Haifa and Yaffa newspapers, Al Carmen and Philistine, published over 200 articles warning about the danger of Zionism for the Palestinians. Scores of articles per year in each newspaper. Among the peasantry in areas of intensive colonization, Zionist inroads were felt in concrete terms as land purchase led to the removal of Arab peasants working on the land. Their concerns were shared by Arab city dwellers who observed with mounting concern the constant arrival of new European Jewish immigrants. This was before the war. Once the war had taken place, news of the Balfour Declaration reached Palestine only with much delay after November 2nd. All local newspapers had been closed since the beginning of the war. There were no papers in Palestine. Then, after British troops occupied the country, strict military occupation regime banned news of the declaration from being spread. The British did not want the population to know what they had pledged in the Balfour Declaration. They did not allow newspapers to open for 2 years after 1917. In fact, it was not until 1920 the first Palestinian papers were allowed to reopen. There were other reasons, however, for the delayed Palestinian reaction to the Balfour Declaration. These relate to the extraordinary wartime conditions that prevailed in Palestine and that caused intense suffering. The country had been the scene of more than a year of intense battles between British and Ottoman forces, which continued until 1918, such that by the end of the war, Palestinians were already prostrated and exhausted by severe wartime shortages, famine, penury, dislocation, the requisitioning of draft animals, and the conscription of almost every able-bodied man into the Ottoman army. Of all the major combatant powers, the Ottoman Empire suffered the heaviest wartime death toll. Britain, France, Germany suffered around 4% casualties in their adult male population. The Ottoman death toll was over 3 million dead, or 15% of the total population. Most of these people were civilians. In Greater Syria, including Palestine, there were 500,000 deaths due to famine alone between 1915 and 1918. Civilian deaths were compounded by horrific wartime casualties. 750,000 Ottoman soldiers out of the 2.8 million who had been mobilized died during the war. One in four soldiers died in Ottoman service. The impact of all of these factors on Palestine was intense. It's estimated that after growing over 1% annually in all of the pre-war years, the population of Palestine declined by 6% during World War I. It was against this grim background of mass suffering and the advance of British troops that Palestinians eventually learned about the issuance of the Balfour Declaration. The British tried to prevent them from learning about it, but they did learn about it. The shock of hearing about this promise to the Zionist movement by Lord Balfour was exacerbated by a British occupation that marked the end of 400 years of Ottoman sovereignty, a regime which had prevailed for a full 20 generations, almost twice the lifetime of the American Republic. There was nevertheless a rapid evolution in the way that Palestinians saw themselves during and after World War I. In a world where nationalism had been gaining ground for decades, a world war that had been driven by unrestrained nationalist sentiment provided a major boost to the national idea in Palestine and in other areas of the world. The enhanced salience of nationalism was compounded by the espousal in 1917 by both Woodrow Wilson and Vladimir Lenin of the principle of national self-determination. The endorsement of the national principle by two ostensibly anti-colonial powers had an enormous impact on peoples the world over. As a result of the hopes aroused and then disappointed by Wilson's 14 points, by the Bolshevik Revolution, by the Paris Peace Conference, there were massive anti-colonial upheavals in India, in Korea, in Egypt, and in many other countries. Now, I would argue that as a result of World War I and what followed, the Palestinians were suffering from what might be described as collective post-traumatic stress syndrome. And in a situation like this, they had to face entirely new realities as they entered a new post-war world suffused by nationalist fervor. The Ottoman Empire was now gone. It was replaced by the hegemony of the British and French empires, which in 1915 and 1916 had secretly carried out a self-interested colonial partition of the region, which we know as the Sykes-Picot Accords, that was publicly revealed only in 1917. Against this could be set the possibilities of Arab independence and self-determination, which had been promised secretly by Britain to Sharif Hussein of Mecca in 1916, and which was the subject of repeated British public pledges thereafter. Now, listen closely, because while these British promises were at best partially and belatedly kept as regards other Arab peoples, they were never honored where the Arab population of Palestine was concerned. So while other Middle Eastern countries eventually achieved a measure of independence in the interwar period, no such option was on offer for the Palestinians. In Palestine, Great Britain operated with an entirely different set of rules than in other League of Nations mandates. Unlike all other Class A mandates, so-called, which had been established in the former Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire, all of which were treated in accordance with Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations as provisionally independent nations, Palestine and Palestine alone was denied such treatment. Instead, Palestine and the Palestinians faced a set of rules rigidly dictated by the terms of the Balfour Declaration, and the declaration, as we know, had been tailored to suit the desiderata of Zionism, a European colonizing project and a national movement which had now acquired as its patron a formidable army, a formidable empire whose armies were just then in the process of conquering Palestine. British troops were not to leave the country for over 30 years, by which time the Zionist enterprise had become firmly entrenched. As soon as they were able to do so, in the wake of World War I, the Palestinians began to challenge vigorously both the form of governance imposed by the British, based on the Balfour Declaration, and the introduction of the Zionist movement as a privileged interlocutor of the British. They did so initially in the shadow of a strict British military occupation regime that lasted until 1920 and was followed by a rule by a series of British high commissioners. The first of these high commissioners was Sir Herbert Samuel, a former cabinet minister and dedicated Zionist who laid the governmental foundations for much of what followed. In understanding the unsuccessful efforts of the Palestinians to oppose this regime, two crucial factors are of paramount importance. The first factor is that unlike most other peoples who fell under the sway of colonial rule, the Palestinians had to contend not only with the colonial power in the metropole, but also with the terms of the Balfour Declaration. They thus had to deal with a colonial settler movement, which, while it was beholden to Britain, was independent of Britain, and which had a powerful national impulse and an international base. Most importantly, they had a base in this country, in the United States. The second factor is that Britain did not rule Palestine outright as a colonial possession. It ruled Palestine as a mandatory power of the League of Nations. In rejecting Palestinian protests about the Balfour Declaration, British officials could simply point to the international legitimacy for its terms that was provided by the 1922 League of Nations mandate for Palestine, which, at the instigation of the British themselves, had incorporated verbatim the text of the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration constitutes the introduction to the League of Nations mandate for Palestine. It's the preamble to the mandate. In 7 of the 28 articles of that mandate, there is an effort to substantially amplify and expand on the commitments of the Balfour Declaration. So the mandate is, in effect, an elaboration of the Balfour Declaration. Thus, the British government could hide behind the terms of their League of Nations mandate in denying the Palestinians treatment as an independent nation in accordance with Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. I would therefore argue that the Palestinians were in a triple bind. This may have been unique in the entire history of the resistance of indigenous peoples to European colonialism. They faced the might of the British Empire in an era between the world wars in which not one single colonial possession, with the partial exception of Ireland, succeeded in freeing itself from the clutches of the European powers. This was not an age of liberation. This was not an age of decolonization. It was an age in which the colonial empires maintained their power. The Palestinians faced as well an international colonizing movement with a national mission and with its own independent sources of finance and support, besides those which were generously offered by Britain. And finally, they were confronted with the international legitimacy that was accorded to British rule by the League of Nations, which had sanctified the Balfour Declaration and its colonial import for the Palestinians by endowing it with the legal imprimatur of the preeminent international body of its day. The Balfour Declaration was thus transmogrified, transformed. It became more than just a statement by the British cabinet. It became an internationally sanctioned legal document. In explaining the failure of the Palestinians to retain control of their ancestral homeland, alongside understanding the shortcomings of their leaders and the hindrances that resulted from fissures within Palestinian society, we must keep in mind the triple bind they were in, facing Britain, Zionism, and international legitimacy. Now, before November 2nd, 1917, the Zionist movement was both a national movement in embryo and a colonial enterprise without a fixed metropole, like an orphan searching for a foster parent. When it found such a parent in Great Britain, as symbolized by the Balfour Declaration, the colonization and transformation of Arab Palestine into a Jewish state could begin in earnest. This process was backed very soon afterwards, as I've suggested, by the international legitimacy provided by the League of Nations mandate. Importantly, however, it was backed as well by an indispensable iron wall of British bayonets, in the words of that most forthright of Zionist leaders, Zev Jabotinsky. It was not just international legitimacy, it was also British bayonets that supported this process. Seen from the perspective of the Palestinian people, the careful, calibrated, diplomatic prose of the Balfour Declaration amounted, as I've suggested, to a declaration of war on them. For the next few decades, this war was waged in several ways. It was waged by the Zionist movement with money, legal means, propaganda, and finally with mortars and car bombs. It was waged by the British Empire with multiple forms of repression, prison camps, exile, summary executions, warplanes, tanks, and artillery. By the end of the Arab revolt in Palestine in 1939, 10% of the adult male population of Palestine was dead, wounded, imprisoned, or in exile. That is a very heavy weight of British repression employed in service of this project. The issuance of the Balfour Declaration, therefore, I submit, marked the beginning of a century-long colonial conflict in Palestine, supported by an array of outside powers. In much different forms, this conflict continues until this day. Now, I realize that I may have imposed on your patience by summarizing some of the history around the Balfour Declaration and how it affected the Palestinians. Some would say that we should forget history in dealing with the Palestine conflict. I would suggest that those who say something along these lines have an absolutely miserable track record of failure in attempting to resolve the core issues at stake, specifically the conflict between the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. Ignoring history is one of the things that has brought us to where we are in 2017. In fact, I would argue, I'm a historian, so I would do this, but I would nevertheless argue that this historical background is essential to understanding why this conflict has lasted for so long and is essential to understanding how it might be justly resolved. This background also helps us to understand that it did not begin in 1967 or in 1948, as some short-sighted observers would have it. Finally, this background points out the avenue towards a real, lasting, sustainable peace and towards real reconciliation and compromise between the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. Reconciliation, as the South Africans can attest, depends on acknowledging historical realities rather than ignoring them. Genuine compromise must be based on justice and absolutely equal treatment and absolutely equal rights for all. It must not, it cannot be based on the imposition of the will of the stronger on the weaker. That is not compromise. That is something else. I would argue that this historical background points to another fact. And this is something that I can say here in a body that has over 200 members, most of which are not great powers. What I am about to say may offend the great powers, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'm not a diplomat. I can say whatever I please. And this fact is the following. It is that peace between Palestine and Israel is far too important to be left to the self-interested ministrations of the great powers alone. Again and again, the history of the League of Nations, the history of the United Nations, show us that these great powers were responsible for imposing formulas in Palestine that suited their interests of the moment. In every single case, these formulas created, exacerbated, and magnified this conflict. In so doing, these great powers have ignored international law, and they have ignored essential elements of the covenants and charters that they themselves helped to shape, such as the principle of self-determination that animates both the covenant of the League of Nations and the Charter of the United Nations. If there's one defining principle behind those two documents, crafted essentially by the great powers of the day themselves, it is the principle of self-determination. It's this principle that has been ignored in one respect in Palestine. As someone who is the son of an international civil servant who faithfully served the United Nations for his entire career, I have been a close witness for many decades to the failures of this body, of the United Nations, to live up to its principles where Palestine is concerned. I was sitting in the Security Council chamber as a visitor when the United Nations Security Council attempted to pass a ceasefire resolution in June 1967. I used to come to this building all the time. There was no security in those days. One could enter very easily. So I have witnessed episode after episode after episode of this failure, which I would ascribe largely to the machinations of the great powers. I am not naive, however. And as a historian, I know all too well that power has its prerogatives. We see that most clearly, of course, in the Security Council. But the United Nations was not set up to make the world a more comfortable place for the powerful, but rather to bring peace with justice and to bring the rule of international law. Over the 100 years since the Balfour Declaration was issued, over the 70 years since the passage of UN General Assembly Resolution 181 in this month in 1947, in the 50 years since the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 242 in this month in 1967, neither peace with justice nor the rule of law has prevailed where Palestine is concerned. It is high time for the United Nations and the entire world community to act in this spirit. Specifically, after a full century, it is high time that the establishment of a national home promised by Balfour and the League of Nations to the Jewish people in 1917 and afterwards be matched by the establishment of a national home for the Palestinian people. After 70 full years, it is high time that the national self-determination promised to the Israeli people by the United Nations General Assembly in November 1947, and that the Israeli people have enjoyed since 1948, be enjoyed by the Palestinian people. And after 50 full years, it is high time for the injunction in UN Security Council resolution forbidding, quote, the acquisition of territory by war to be vigorously enforced where the territories occupied in 1967 are concerned. Finally, it is high time for the United Nations and for the entire international community to take vigorous action, belatedly, to break the century-old logjam created and perpetuated by the great powers. This man-made logjam has prevented the principle of self-determination from being applied fairly and equally to both parties of this conflict, the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. They both deserve the peace and stability that only an equitable resolution of the conflict between them on the basis of international law and in a spirit of justice and equality would bring. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Palestinian historian Rashi Khalidi speaking at the UN on the impact of the Balfour Declaration on the Palestinian people.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. George Michael, a prophet of our age, like all the icons on the side of the angels, why do angels like him all seem to keel over prematurely? Israeli armed forces launch a series of attacks against not ISIS, but the Syrian Arab Army. What happened exactly? And more to the point, why haven't we heard about this on the UK news? Plus, infiltration, not just of companies and charities, but any organisation that stands against the New World Order. We hear from the long-time environmental campaigner, now retired and editing FRAC News, Frances Leader, about what she calls the five different types of infiltrator she's come across in her four decades of campaigning. Yes, and Tony Blair. The greatest war criminal of all time from Britain? Who knows? Well, back in 2003, singer and musician George Michael had a few things to say about Mr. Blair. Could he even have been something of a prophet for our time? And we hear an extract tonight from his appearance on the BBC's Hard Talk show from 2003. Pretty shocking stuff. And we look at the 1970s too, at the child abuse in the children's home in Kinkora in Northern Ireland. And from someone who tried to blow the whistle on it, eventually managing to, that his name was Colin Wallace, who worked for the British military. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon most Tuesdays, but you can be sure to catch it online this week, a look at the critics of the Israeli state at home and abroad. Jackie Walker is a suspended Jewish Labour Party member who spoke about the role of Jews in the early days of the slave trade. She's been suspended now for pretty much 2 years, but she's doing a play in Bristol, a one-woman play about her family and why she said what she said. And can a Jew be anti-Semitic? Also, from Stockholm, Sweden, journalist Chris Bollins, the author of Solving 9/11, he's accumulated evidence that dual American Israeli citizens may have been involved in perpetrating the 9/11 attacks. I ask him for the evidence. And in the cover-up, too. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, hopefully, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Martin, we've had airstrikes and what looked like standoff missiles, that's cruise missile strikes, against Syria by the Israelis, but very, very little, if any, reporting. I haven't seen it anywhere on the news here. So what's happened and why haven't we heard?
Well, I mean, it is out there. It's not as if people don't know about it. It's just not the sort of thing that you're going to see on mainstream news in Britain, which is still very much controlled information, basically, on Syria. There's still basically attempts to mislead people about what's going on, who's fighting who about what. What's interesting is that the Syrians haven't really retaliated. And I think what it is, the Israelis can actually attack with relative impunity, although they have fired back as they've come in. But they're not retaliating because they've got plenty of other people to fight. So the Israelis are just adding to the chaos. And, of course, the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists have been coming in and out of Israeli-controlled territory, just as they've been coming in and out of Jordan, where the British are operating. And I was reading this afternoon earlier on South Front that various ISIS fighters are now being reintegrated into other units. And the Russian Ministry of Defence claims that ISIS fighters are being retrained by British personnel in Al-Tanf. Now, in other words, the war is very complicated, but not as complicated. One of the other things I was reading, they've got prisoners of war from over 65 or 85 countries, the Syrian army. So there are 5,000 people from Uyghurs from China fighting inside Syria to overthrow the Syrian government. But of course, having these people from all over the world fighting to overthrow the government has done nothing really to endear the revolutionaries, if we can call them that, to the local population. And they're losing the war.
Also, we've had this apparent drone swarm attack.
Yeah.
Russia's been talking about. But hang on, before we talk about that, I think we should really just be clear. What happened? I think it was beginning of this week, wasn't it? Monday or Sunday. Because I understand it was several attacks by the Israelis against Syria. Who was being attacked and what were they
using? Well, the Israelis claim that they're...
It was all early morning stuff,
yeah,
about 3 in the morning.
The Israelis claim that they're going for Hezbollah-linked stuff. And there's supposedly, it's whispered that there's an understanding with the Russians that if they just go after Hezbollah-linked stuff, the Russians won't bring their air defences into play. But the Syrians, of course, have not necessarily party to that, and they have fired back at the Israelis coming over the border. But, of course, we're all on a hair trigger here. aircraft are flying around over Syria, and at any moment a decision could be made by one of the people, either for, you know, piloting the drones or the aircraft, to shoot at somebody else. And we, you know, we've got a shooting war. I mean, in the 1982 war in Lebanon, there was worries that the Syrians would shoot down, Russian equipment, would shoot down an Israeli plane, and then we'd be off to World War III.
So the Russians had a drone swarm attack on their base too, in Syria. I guess that's a Tarsus base, or maybe
the Latakia.
Latakia base. Okay, so a swarm of drones started to attack the Russians.
Well, what the Russians are saying is they managed to shoot most of them down, and they managed to capture some of them.
They hacked some, didn't they?
Some of them. They said that.
So that means you can actually bring it down intact.
Yeah. And they've also said today that they've assassinated the people who sent them. But what they've also said is that these were not homemade drones. They're actually, you know, they've been made at a high level of technological sophistication. And they said, we know who did it, and it wasn't the Israelis, and it wasn't the Turks. And, of course, there was an American spy plane flying around while they were being
used. So these U.S.
So in other
planes...
Words, without directly accusing the U.S., they are accusing
this
the U.S.
This U.S. plane is called a... gosh, I'm not even sure what this thing is. US P-8 patrol plane can fly around. I mean, it looks just like a kind of airliner, grey airliner with no windows in the sides, with two engines, the sort of thing you might see taking off from Bristol Airport. But so that could be used to possibly control those drones. I suppose actually the drones could even be controlled from RAF Waddington or somewhere, you know, thousands of miles away.
Yeah, well, I think what they've tried to do, let's just try and put the jigsaw puzzle together. These drones have been supplied to Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists. They didn't build them on their own. I mean, the Russians are saying, no, these are too sophisticated to be homemade stuff. And we know that a foreign state was involved. And they said it's not the Turks and it's not the Israelis. So I think, you know, if you think back through, that means they believe that the Americans were behind it.
So why are the Russians just being straight and saying we think this is the Americans?
Well, because they know that if they say it's the Americans, then they've got to take retaliatory measures. And if they do want to take retaliatory measures, and they might, they want to...
Well, maybe they have.
Well, maybe they have. That's right. We can both play the game of plausible deniability. The reason why they've put it in the hands of these Al-Qaeda terrorists. Incidentally, of course, the important thing for listeners to get is that the West is still cooperating with Al-Qaeda terrorists, as they always have been for many, many years. And, of course, the Russian general staff are very well aware that Al-Qaeda and the Western intelligence services are pretty much the same thing. There's a cutout involved. So it looks as if the rebels did it themselves, but in actual fact they couldn't have done it without support from Western intelligence services, and particularly the CIA. And, of course, what they're trying to do is they're trying to mess up the end game, in what's going on. But I understand Erdogan and Putin have already spoken about this, and Putin's satisfied that the Turks were not responsible for what happened.
In the background to all of this, we've got President Xi telling his army not to fear death in a show of China's military might. President is telling Chinese armed forces to be capable of combat and sure to win in a move designed to bolster his political standing. This was reported by The Guardian. You can imagine the picture with President Xi standing on this giant sort of Soviet-style podium with tens of thousands of troops all in line beneath him. Do not fear death. Be capable of combat and be sure to win.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, what senior Chinese military are saying, we can't presume that this war in Korea isn't going to turn into a major war in which we're going to have to be involved. So we've got to be prepared for it. It's like as if North Korea was going on in France, I'm quite sure we would all be running around preparing for the fallout if it turned into a full-on fight.
Also, another fascinating story this week, how hackers could trigger nuclear war. Warning weapons that rely on new technology are vulnerable to cyber attacks. The Chatham House think tank warns that Trident could be hacked or sabotaged. The paper says hackers could spread false information prompting a launch. Its authors say nuclear strategy often overlooks the use of digital technology. Well, this is the sort of thing we've been saying for years here. Chatham House, who are they?
Well, they're a sort of a very semi-official think tank. Which
I love your term semi-official because
they're not part of the government, but they might.
They're basically funded by private companies and banks, aren't they? Yeah. And they basically do foreign policy, but some kind of privatised version of foreign policy. So they're in a position to know about hacking. I mean, they're because a lot of their private companies are doing it.
Yes, and I mean, Chatham House has been around for quite a long time. It's also called the Royal Forums in which the big cheeses get together and with the little cheeses and discuss.
It's also called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. It was set up in a sort of parallel way as the Council on Foreign Relations was in the United States. Now the idea is these organisations. I mean, this is my take on it anyway, Martin. Is they stalk the Foreign Office, they stalk the State Department, and often when they're addressing a specific issue, they are massively more funded than the official government body to come up with. You know, this is why you should do this policy and that policy.
Yes, I mean it's one of the conveyor belts by which the elite get the policies they want from the infrastructure which they see as belonging to them.
So, what do you think? Is it possible that there could be a? We did have, didn't we, the launch of a nuclear test missile from one of the Trident submarines that headed off in the wrong direction towards the United States? Could that have been hacked?
Possibly. I mean, the fact is that when it comes to a final showdown in warfare, what the Russians have been trying to show is that we can hack all of your stuff. And Hezbollah, years ago, when they were accused of assassinating Afikariri in Lebanon, they said, we don't really want to do this, but they gave a press conference where they'd hacked into the Israeli drone, which was flying over the scene, and saying, well, this is who killed Hariri. And we've hacked into the drone. But they didn't really want to show that because the Israelis then realised that their drones had been hacked. And, of course, real modern warfare is all about digital technology. And so, for example, what the Russians did when the cruise missiles was sent at the air base after the so-called chemical weapons attack at Idlib is most of those cruise missiles were simply diverted by hacking. And, of course, what you could envisage is that somebody decides to press the button to attack somebody, and then the other side just hacks all of the things and says, your instructions, missile, are to return to base. And then, of course, the people who've sent the missiles off, the missile comes straight back.
I seem to remember a James Bond film rather like that. But anyway, I suppose what we could be talking about here is Theresa May ordering Moscow to be nuked by a Trident sub in the Atlantic, and then that Trident missile then just landing in the middle of London, blowing London to pieces.
Well, yes, I mean, and everybody who's involved in this at a high level realises that this is a feasible
thing. So this is an old technology, but the hacking thing almost trumps it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's why you might want to go back to old technology where you really just crank it up and
so are there any examples of that?
Well, I mean, the Russians in general have the philosophy of what their electronic war capability seems to me to be mostly about is just knocking out the other side's electronics. So that they've got, they can't communicate. The USS Donald Cook, the spy ship, they just knocked out all the electronics.
That was in the Black Sea, wasn't it? I mean, our studio here,
they did it again in the Baltic.
In our studio here.
They did it in the Baltic, they did exactly the same.
Without the electronics, you wouldn't hear a thing. I can tell you that. Back in the old days, I suppose, it would have been valves and that kind of stuff. That still would work. But the integrated circuits all would get knocked out by these things. Mm-hmm. And also, if they don't get knocked out, they could be hacked into. Also, great series. I have to say this, Mike Rudin. I mean, someone who we criticised, Martin and I certainly, for many years, over his conspiracy Files series, which was just basically a whole load of BBC cover-ups for the real criminals in various things like the 7/7 London bombings, the 9/11 attacks, the death of Princess Diana, the Oklahoma City bombing. He's now, it seems, had a fit of conscience at the BBC. He's done a series, three-part series called The House of Saud, A Family at War. Three-part series which examines the Saudi Arabian royal family and actually is in a very critical light.
Well, obviously, I haven't watched them, so I'm not quite sure whether they're as good as some people seem to say they are, but people I respect have watched it and said, this is a much more robust piece of journalism than some of the previous stuff he's done.
What's the main problem with Saudi Arabia, then, in your view? And there's two more of these to come, by the way. They're on, I'll just tell you exactly when they're on. They are on, the 5th of January was, it's Fridays, actually, Friday evenings.
Yeah, well, I mean, and presumably they're available on catch-up for those who don't get them when they're first broadcast. I mean, I'm vaguely aware of what's in these programmes, but I haven't seen them. And I think what it suggests...
Okay, let's just hear it from you. What is the main problem with Saudi Arabia? Well, given that it was set up by the Brits, Saudi Arabia...
Basically, it's a puppet state run by a kind of extended mafia, which, you know, were put in power by the British and then taken over by the Americans to control a major oil supply and make sure that it, you know, and of course the Saudi Arabian role in OPEC protects the petrodollar, which allows Trump to carry out tax cuts and carry out military expenditure, and the stock market rises.
But what about the geopolitics of it are that the major opponents of the whole Crusader project, the Israeli state in the Middle East, are the Arab countries. And Saudi Arabia is supposed to be an Arab country. You would expect that Saudi Arabia would be a political opponent of Israel.
Well, officially they are. So, you know, MS, whatever his name is, the Crown Prince dictator.
MBS.
MDS. He had to come out with a, yes, we don't agree with this recognition of Jerusalem thing. So it was a bit embarrassing from their point of view. But, of course, what they are is they are touted by the West, and they were originally conceived of by the British as the leaders of the Arab world because they control Mecca and Medina. But, of course, they are, in fact, there's no particular reason why they, the Al Saud family and their allies, should be in control of Medina and Mecca. And Saudi Arabia is essentially a glass pillar in the private sector in the Saudi Arabia. I was reading the other day, only 15% of people working in the private sector in Saudi Arabia are Saudi Arabians. So the Saudi Arabian citizenry, Sunni citizenry, lives on benefits and handouts, and the work is done by foreign workers and Shias. And in actual fact...
Isn't that a bit like Britain?
Well, no.
I mean, we've got lots and lots of foreign workers imported into Britain.
Well, no, I mean, but 15%, only 15% of the private sector is locals. Yeah, 85% are from somewhere else in the private sector in Saudi Arabia.
Anyway, also the excellent Middle East Monitor. They are creating new perspectives. That's what they say they're doing. But interesting story from them this week. Benjamin Netanyahu's son is boasting of his father's gas deal at a strip club. I'm not sure if he's necessarily following the Torah, going visiting strip clubs and things. But anyway, a recording emerged this week of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's son, Yair, Y-A-I-R, boasting that his father has set up a $20 billion business deal for businessman and gas tycoon Kobi Maimon. And published in the Israel television news company, the report stirred renewed controversy at a time when Netanyahu is being investigated on allegations of corruption. The recording dates back to 2015, when during a night out, he and his friends were reportedly ferried from one strip club to another by Netanyahu's government-provided security. "Bro, you got to spot me," he said. "My dad made an awesome deal for your dad, bro. He fought in the Knesset for this." Yair can be heard saying in Hebrew, "My dad set up a $20 billion deal for your dad, and you're fighting with me about 400 shekels." That was apparently over paying for a prostitute. So this doesn't help Netanyahu, because there is all these allegations running through the Israeli courts at the moment about him accepting bribes of various sorts. And in fact, there's virtually unreported demonstrations been going on in major cities in Israel over this.
Well, I mean, he's a shady character, without a doubt, and his son obviously has an enormous sense of entitlement, etc. What I wonder is, how accidental is it that this has all come out, or has somebody in Shin Bet, for example, who's hostile to Netanyahu, made sure that they got hold of this recording and broadcast it? But don't forget, everybody these days has got to be aware that anything you say to anybody, even in a strip club with the music playing, if they've got their phone switched on, then they can probably record it, and
won't hear it. Next week's Dialect with Jackie Walker talks quite a lot about the whole sort of background to Israel and Israeli politics. As she's Jewish, mm-hmm. she does feel that it's her job and her ability to criticise the Israelis, mm-hmm. and that she's been suspended now for nearly 2 years by the Labour Party for doing so. And one of the things she explains is that the media in this country is absolutely scared to death to report anything negatively about Israel. She talks in that interview to be broadcast around about midday, or I suppose about quarter past midday next Tuesday here on BCFM. She talks about when a programme is broadcast, that the BBC and others, they will get thousands, sometimes hundreds at least, of complaints, a barrage of complaints, as before the programme's even finished going out, if it's critical of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, and we know that the Israeli government, they talk about Putin bots and all the rest of it, but we know that the Israeli government employs thousands of people to sit there on social media slagging off everything.
So
they
why have we
like.
This is what I mean, why have we heard about the Putin bots but not the Netanyahu bots?
Because it's all to do with mind control and propaganda and people management. I mean, you know, it's the things we're supposed to care about are the things we care, and the things we don't want to know about. We don't hear anything. We don't hear very much about what's going on in Yemen, even though it's clearly one of the biggest crimes going on at the moment. And that's because our military are involved in those crimes, in which tens of thousands of civilians have died. It doesn't really fit with our self-image, so we don't even talk about it. Although occasionally they have to mention, oh, blimey, all these people are dying, and we're involved.
Well, I can just say from a journalist's point of view, journalist's perspective, it's very difficult to get work if you're going to criticise. I mean, what happens is you get editors with a specific point of view, particularly right across London, and then you've just got to basically you've got to think to yourself as a journalist, well, what would the editor say, and sit down and say it. And if you say something which is critical of Israel, you might well find yourself in a situation where you lose your job. Now, the point being here that, you know, we're in a labour market now where you can lose everything if you lose your job. Yeah. There isn't really a proper social security safety net anymore. You could possibly find yourself one of these people who's been criticised by the businesses in Bristol for having their belongings in the city centre because they've been made homeless for one reason or another. So I just thought it'd be interesting to look at the sort of bigger picture here from 2008 particularly and the bailouts, why there's just not enough money around and why there doesn't seem to be any proper regulation of the banks. So we're regulating people who are keeping their belongings in the street, in the city centre, but the people who are responsible for that, the banksters, are getting away with it scot-free. So let's have a listen now to one of the former banking regulators, William Black, who testified back in around about 2008, actually, or maybe a little bit before, over in the US, explaining why sometimes he, as an ex-regulator, had managed to completely stop these crises unfolding by actually prosecuting and jailing bankers, but why that is now not happening.
We stopped a non-prime crisis before it became a crisis in 1991 by supervisory actions. We did it so effectively that people have forgotten it even existed, even though it caused several hundred million dollars in losses, but none to the taxpayers. We did it by preemptive litigation and by supervision. We broke a raging epidemic of accounting control fraud without new legislation in the period 1984 through 1986. Legislation would have been helpful. We sought legislation, but we didn't get it. And we were able to stop that because we didn't simply continue business as usual. Lehman's failure is a story in large part of fraud. And it is fraud that begins at the absolute latest in 2001. And that is with their subprime and their liar's loan operation. Lehman was the leading purveyor of liar's loans in the world for most of this decade. Studies on liar's loans show incidence of fraud of 90%. Lehman sold this to the world with reps and warranties that there were no such frauds. Financial institution leaders are not engaged in risk when they engage in liar's loans. Liar's loans will cause a failure. They lose money. The only way to make money is to deceive others by selling bad paper, and that will eventually lead to liability and failure as well. When people cheat, you cannot, as a regulator, continue business as usual. They go into a different category, and you must act completely differently as a regulator. When we've gotten and said sad excuses, the SEC, we're told there are only 24 people in their comprehensive program. Who decided how many people there would be in their comprehensive program? Who decided the staffing? The SEC did. To say that we only had 24 people is not to create an excuse. It's to give an admission of criminal negligence, except it's not criminal because you're a federal employee.
Yeah, well, Peter Galbraith, who is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous economist, he's at the University of Texas, and he's a bit of an expert on this. And he basically says that it is fraud, and if you allow fraud, if you think about it, if you allow fraud in the system, people who are not being fraudulent can't keep up. If you can't keep up with the bottom line of Lehman's who are involved in fraud, and Lehman's are getting away with fraud, then everybody else has to start copying Lehman's to stay in business. And that's why you've got to jump on it. And, of course, in the 1980s, when the savings and loans scam, like Silverado collapsed with one of the Bush families on the board and all the rest of it, over 1,000 people were sent to prison, and that was in the Reagan era. But now, of course, nobody gets sent to prison, because if anybody gets sent to prison, everybody's got to be sent to prison, so nobody's sent to prison. Meanwhile, we're cutting benefits for poor people, while these other people who've been taking massive amounts of money from the taxpayer not only are not punished, they are rewarded.
Well, like literally today, we've seen, or no, sorry, yesterday, we've seen PricewaterhouseCoopers slapped with a 2-year ban in India over fraud there. This is, that means that PricewaterhouseCoopers has to sever all contracts that it's got with companies in India and now and can't do anything for 2 years. We've also heard earlier on about the role of KPMG in the Grenfell Tower inquiry, being also the auditors for companies that were supposedly or may even be up for being prosecuted as part of that inquiry. Here in Bristol, we had, didn't we, under George Ferguson, we had a volunteer from KPMG working very closely with George Ferguson in the mayor's office. We've now got KPMG in Bristol City Office with Marvin Rees. It's interesting that he seems to have been interested, Marvin, in getting rid of these various service directors, the senior staff in the City Council, but he's not got rid of KPMG from the City Council. We've also got them involved in auditing the Bristol Arena project and the Brabazon project and the Filton projects as well. So these auditors, it seems, are everywhere and nobody really seems to do anything about them. But I mean, effectively, what he was talking about there, we just heard there from William Black, the US regulator, who was really telling people how they should be doing things back in 2008, but they weren't, how they'd done things before, is that what we're dealing with here is what he calls accounting control fraud. Now, it seems to me that auditors are the only people who are really going to pick up on that. And if the auditors are themselves crooked, that's the only way that you're not going to find out about accounting control fraud. That is supposed to be the money that's paid to auditors is to stop that.
Yeah, well, if you look what happened with Arthur Andersen and Enron, and Andersen, because they were involved in covering it all up and making it, you know, basically enabling it all, they went down the drain. But, of course, you then end up with even fewer auditors who are going to be, you know, it's basically an oligopoly of auditors, so there's no real competition. You know, there's only a certain number of auditors you can go to. And the other thing, of course, is that the way it works is organisations pay these organisations to audit them, and they don't pay them to come in and say you're doing this all wrong, you're criminals. So the incentive system is all wrong.
In China...
You know, the auditors ought to be completely independent.
And they should
come in and say, right, well, you're not doing this right, we're going to prosecute.
I noticed in China, too, in December, there is a suggestion that KPMG may be stopped from acting in China because of something to do with their medical auditing, state medical auditing in China, which KPMG were involved in. There was fraud going on there, so they're now talking about removing KPMG from China completely. In South Africa, the KPMG partners have been accused of contempt of court, also in Hong Kong. At what point are some of these KPMG directors and partners going to be arrested and tried by the police? Because it doesn't seem that any of these frauds, which appear to have been going on, that there's any action being taken on them whatsoever.
Well, the fact of the matter is, with all of this stuff, it's just the cost of doing business, isn't it?
It just seems to me so utterly wrong that people in the city centre with no belongings are the subject of action, where the people who are actually conducting the massive fraud on an international scale are just left to go free.
Well, I mean, that's the way the world works, isn't it? We know that's how it is. It shouldn't be, but it is. And the fact is, the fact of the matter is, there's all sorts of criminal activity going on. But of course, the incentives within the system, if you get caught involved in fraud or rigging the LIBOR rate or whatever, nobody goes to prison. The organisation has to pay a paltry fine, but the profits to be made by playing fast and loose with the figures are enormous. So it's just, you know, occasionally they have to pay a fine when they get caught. And apart from that, there's no particular, it's just a cost. They just factor that in to what they're doing. And the whole system is crooked from top to bottom and has been for years, which is why it collapsed in 2008. And, of course, it's still exactly the same now, if not worse than it was in 2008. The idea that it's somehow been cleaned up and we've all moved on is absolutely fatuous.
So, anyway, at the top of the hour, I was talking about Tony Blair as the greatest British war criminal of all time. Now, that sounds like it might be an exaggeration. Can you think of anybody who was worse?
Well, Churchill did kill an awful lot of people in Dresden. He killed the Kurds. He was the first one to drop chemical weapons on the Kurds in
the
1920s.
Didn't you do a podcast recently?
There was a huge famine in Bengal in the 1940s, which people think that he was responsible for the deaths. I don't know.
Podcast recently on, was it in Gallipoli?
No, on the Crimean War.
Oh, on the Crimean War. Tell us a little bit about that podcast. Who was it with and what did you talk about?
I'm trying to remember who. It's called the Priory Podcast, I believe. And
we'll put a link on our show page. But give us a quick process.
We were just discussing the Crimean War and its historical
context.
Okay,
when was it then? And what was it about?
The Crimean War was in the 1850s. But we were talking about the actual history.
Crimea now, of course, is an interesting point, isn't it? Because this was part of Ukraine, but then became part of, it's now part of Russia pretty much, isn't it?
Well, it always was part of Russia.
There was a big tension over it. Tension over it to this day. But anyway, tell us what, about the original Crimean War.
There was tension around the holy places in Jerusalem, which were then resolved. There was tension about whether the Russians could use the Black Sea and the Dardanelles to move their ships around, because Sebastopol was their major port. Anyway, there were various kind of beatings of chests and rowing, and basically the Russians backed down over most things. But by the time the Russians backed down, the fleets were already sailing, the British and the French, to join the Turks. And then they attacked Crimea because they couldn't think of anywhere else to attack them. They've arrived, they were originally going to fight in Romania, but the Russians withdrew, and therefore there was no reason to fight them in Romania, so they ended up fighting them in Crimea because there was nowhere else to fight them. So this is
just part of the long-running dislike of Russia. What is this all about?
Well, I mean, don't forget that at that time, you've still got the fear was that the Russians were going to take away India from us. That's what the fear was. The British, oh no, the Russians are going to take India off us, as if India belonged to us in the first place. And of course, there was all sorts of, the British invaded Afghanistan in the 1840s in order to stop the Russians coming in. And then, of course, the Afghans kicked them out. The British army died almost to a man in that particular expedition. But, I mean, these kind of tensions have been going on, whether Russia was communist, czarist, or, modern, democratic capitalist, if you like. And, these tensions are always there. We're still living, the fault lines are still active.
Well, they weren't not long after, were they? Because the Russians joined the British in the First World War as friends.
Well, indeed. And, of course, that's what can happen, is, the kaleidoscope turns and suddenly everybody's on different sides. These kind of political games are still going on. Because most situations are more complicated than having one side who are the goodies with white hats and another side with the baddies with black hats.
Okay, well, we heard
the
last...
reality is a lot more complicated than that.
We heard last week from John Perkins, the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, absolutely fascinating guy. And this week we're going to hear from someone else who was a critic of Tony Blair and George Bush and their policy towards Iraq. I mean, he was saying effectively, wasn't he, that Iraq was there, last week, that there were a whole sort of series of moves made to try and control Iraq and try and control Saddam Hussein. And that the first Gulf War in 1989-1990 was an attempt to just destroy his military so that they could then go to him directly in as an individual and try and persuade him to do what the Anglo-Zionist Empire's oil companies wanted. And then he still wouldn't. So that's why they had to have this invasion in 2003 to take him out, even after having sending in the jackals and then managing not to actually kill Saddam Hussein, which they've been trying to do pre-2003. But anyway, let's hear another angle now, and it's from a very different kind of character to John Perkins. George Michael, the singer, songwriter, musician, who's speaking on BBC's Hard Talk back in 2003.
I'm scared about Mr. Blair's attitude to the future. I think we're at a watershed moment. September the 11th was the first part of this watershed moment, and this is the tail end of it. September the 11th was so obviously directed at America to provoke a response, and the response was supposed to be revenge. We've spent something close to, what is it now? So something close to 18 months trying to prevent that knee-jerk reaction. And if all it's been is delay, then what was the point?
Well, there wasn't a knee-jerk reaction, was there?
No, there wasn't. But you don't think this is...
There's been a properly considered reaction, consultation around the world, hasn't there?
Has there?
Hasn't there?
I don't see any consultation.
American politicians?
I see a lot of bullying.
Checking around the world?
Yes, but do you see them actually saying anything but terrorists? It's either the terrorists or us?
Your complaint is that there hasn't been a debate, that the newspapers...
No. My complaint was, it was 8 months ago, was that there was no debate.
So you've had plenty of debate since then?
Oh, yeah. All of which is being ignored. That's my point. I'm here because I'm
ignored
proud.
Ignored by whom?
By the Prime Minister.
Well, he's seen the need to go out and make the case for what he believes in.
Yes,
that's a response to the debate, isn't it?
Absolutely. And do you not think that his voters have told him they're not convinced by that?
Somehow.
No, 91%.
The country's not united.
91% said without the UN, they didn't want to go in. Didn't you think that's close to unanimous?
You were so much aligned with Blair and Cool Britannia, mm-hmm. weren't you?
No, I wasn't. I never turned up at that bloody party. Excuse me. I was never going to be used that way. When I saw Tony Blair, I saw him in Islington before he got into Downing Street. Right, when he needed people like me, I saw him personally. I went and had a meal with him, discussed it, because my lawyer is a member of the Labour Party.
But you supported it, didn't you?
When?
Then. The Cool Britannia.
I've never believed in Cool Britannia. No, it's not. You're not talking to Noel Gallagher or somebody from the Britpop age. You're talking to somebody who started 21 years ago. Cool Britannia is a load of bollocks to me. I'll be honest,
sorry,
I've been
about
very
the language,
distressed
folks.
By Mr. Blair's behaviour for several years in terms of the way I think he's removed the idealism from politics by taking a supposedly left-of-centre party and calling it Labour or New Labour, and then basically saying that we have to be pragmatic. The left is really, in these overly consumerist times, the
he also said you have to have an ethical foreign policy, didn't he?
Absolutely, and absolutely, this is not ethical, is it? This is a Christian country with supposedly a Christian leader who somehow think that the answer to the future is preemptive action. Now, to me, preemptive action is every bit as dangerous a concept as the initial concept of creating the atomic bomb. And by the way, that was created for the same kind of deterrent purposes by the same nation. And I do not believe that this is any more safe than that.
You'd still vote for him?
No, I wouldn't vote for him. I would never vote for him again. Never vote for him again. Because he's gone beyond the bluff. He's now bullying the UN on behalf of
bullying?
Mr.
Persuading,
Bush.
He would say.
I'd say bullying. You have to be... you cannot ignore statements like... the UN needs to prove its relevance. You cannot ignore the fact that America could sit there and say, you either agree with us or you're irrelevant.
15 members of the Security Council, mm-hmm. unanimous, signed mm-hmm. up to Resolution 1441,
yeah, and it's
calling on Iraq
why.
To disarm.
And it's for the
Is
same
that
reason. It, listen, it's the
Even Syria.
It's the same
against
reason.
Against all expectations.
It's the same reason, right, that they, if they pass this new resolution, which seems a lot more unlikely considering that France and Germany are completely saying there's no need for it, if they pass the new resolution, it will be for the same reason they passed the first one, because they are afraid of extinction. And to me, that is bullying.
What kind of Prime Minister do you want? If you don't want a man who leads on his convictions.
I want somebody who leads on his convictions until the point that they're public.
Until the point that you disagree with them.
No, until the point that 90% of the public disagrees with them.
Well, that's the hard time. That's what he's paid for, isn't it? Take hard decisions. Not to be a populist.
You're not paid to put people's lives in danger and ignore their opinion on that very subject. No one is paid to do that. You're not paid to put people's lives in danger and ignore their opinion on that very subject. No one is paid to do that. Yeah. I have no sympathy with Saddam Hussein. I have no sympathy with him. He should be gone. We need him gone in order to stabilize the region. But you cannot do this at the moment when the entire fundamentalist terrorist network around the world is waiting for this to legitimize what they want to do.
How do you think you've contributed to the debate over Iraq?
Well,
I mean, if you take Shoot the Dog.
Sorry, that was George Michael there speaking back in 2003. I think just interesting sometimes to take a dip back, isn't it? You know, whatever it is, 15 years or so, Martin, to listen to what was being discussed and also to see what's now transpired in the region.
Yeah, and I think just a tribute to George Michael, who died over the Christmas holidays, and he always was an outspoken and honest and honourable guy, and we will miss him. Well, I mean, the points you were making there are pretty obvious. You know, it was a turning point.
Do you think people were conned by Blair? Because he was originally a supporter, wasn't he?
Yes, and of course the point is that
he it also make it clear he didn't die over these Christmas holidays. It was last year, 2016 December, he died.
Yeah. Okay, but I mean the point is that Blair, you know, we've discussed his culpability in these matters many times on this show. It was a turning point. We shouldn't have gone to war in Iraq.
What was going on within your party then?
What was going on?
Yeah, John Smith.
Well, I mean, don't forget there was a vote in the House of Commons about the war in Iraq, in which the Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, resigned and spoke against the government, and in which Blair said to his MPs that unless he had a majority inside the parliamentary Labour Party, he wouldn't proceed, which was to put bullying, you know, basically trying to put pressure on his own MPs. And Clare Short agreed to support the war, which she then subsequently regretted. And if she had voted against Blair, then a majority of the Labour Party in Parliament would have voted against war. Now, that Blair could still have gone to war with Tory
votes.
Are
you saying that Clare Short was responsible for the invasion of Iraq?
Clare Short admits this herself. She says, I was wrong. I was conned by Blair. I shouldn't have done that, and I regret it. And I can accept that as an honest opinion from her. And I think that's the problem. You see, if a majority of the Labour Party in Parliament had voted against the war in Iraq, Blair could have had his war, but it could actually have led to the fall of the government, and it would have been clearly a Tory Blairite war, with the Labour Party absolved from responsibility for all the consequences that have followed, including the rise of ISIS and bombs in Manchester and all the flipping rest of it.
Well, at least your language is more moderate than George Michael's. Thank you, Martin. Now, we're going to go back before the end of the show. We're going to go back and look at some more international stuff. But before that, let's have a listen to Frances Leader, who runs something called Frack News. You can find her on Facebook and elsewhere. She lives down in Devon, and she's been an environmental activist for, in her own admission, 40-plus years. She's now retired, working from home. She's not disabled, but she's not very well. She can't get around very easily, but she can do a lot from her computer. And also, she's had a lot of experience at dealing with the various pressure groups, NGOs, and watching as individuals come in and try and disrupt those groups. So here's what she had to say to me a few weeks ago on Dialect about infiltrating groups and what to watch for.
Well, there are five different types, actually, Tony. There's the ones that come from the government. Those are usually police undercovers, and their main objective is to identify everyone that is involved and feed that information back to the headquarters, and then to target those individuals to literally find any dirt that they can from the past of that person, and then use that to ruin their reputation with other members of the group. They will set one member off against another by saying this one said this about you and then saying the same thing to the other person and causing people to have arguments and fall out. They will get drunk or drugged out of their minds and cause us disrepute by misbehaving in such a way that everyone presumes that all of us are like that, just on the behaviour of one person. They'll get themselves arrested doing things that are completely illegal, again, to put us into disrepute. There are endless games that they play and continue to play. And this has been going on for decades. All the time I've ever known anything about activism is we've dealt with people.
Okay,
like
so
this.
You started with the police there. Can you run through the others?
Yeah. The next one on the list is the people that are employed by the industry. In the case of the oil industry, these are usually very, very well trained, very experienced, and have been involved with the oil industry in the past, and are therefore employed by the oil industry to do pretty much the same things that the police undercovers are doing, but also to misdirect us and make sure that we do not find out some of the really important secrets, such as the exact chemical content of drilling muds and frack fluid. That's a heavily guarded secret throughout the world. And to ensure that we do not find out that those things are severely toxic and carcinogenic, particularly to also make sure that we do not form relationships with people that work in the oil and gas industry so that we do not contaminate them with some truth. That's another thing that they particularly are very keen that we do not do, that we do not have any communication with those people. The next category are the hangers-on, the people that turn up to our events and camps simply because they want to rumble, they want to be fed, they want to make sure that their own income is secure for their drink or drug habits, so they latch onto us for those reasons. And also, there are the very sad individuals who are maybe homeless and are desperate for company, and they're not likely to be quite so disruptive, but because of their reputation and their appearance will give us a bad name. And then finally, there's the actors, and you find these associated with the media. You'll get a media van turn up with all the equipment and cameras and God knows what. But out of the same vehicle, we'll get someone dressed as a clown or in other some ridiculous outfit who will start causing as much attention-grabbing behaviour as they possibly can. And they are then filmed or photographed, and that goes into the newspapers, creating an image that we are not serious, that we are a bunch of idiots, to create a disreputation, if that's not really a real word, but that's what they do. So that's the five categories. There's the police, the industry themselves, the people that are simply freeloading, those that are suffering in society, such as the homeless, and finally the media and their part-time stooges who cause trouble.
Well, I could be forgiven for wondering, Martin Summers, whether some of these campaigns are almost all constructed out of people who are infiltrating.
Well, during the 1950s, every single member of the US Communist Party was actually an FBI agent at one stage, because that's how, and that we now know that there were hundreds of police infiltrators under the Special Demonstration Squad. Some scores have been, they've admitted to, but we know that there were hundreds. So we can presume, I've been an activist for over 30 years, we can presume that virtually everything we've been involved in is infiltrated. And that's no reason for people to panic, or that we shouldn't not do our stuff. We've just got to be aware that that's the world we live in, and we've got to be aware of what goes on.
Looking also at some of the international news, amazing to hear that the Trump visit has been cancelled. He doesn't seem to want to come to Britain for some reason.
Not that amazing, because it's not in either his interests or Theresa May's
interests.
Well,
he's been everywhere else, hasn't he? He's pretty much everywhere else. China, well, France, yes,
he went to Saudi Arabia and he said he was really pleased because there were no demonstrations, unlike elsewhere where he's been.
But maybe he's told Theresa May, unless you can make sure there's no demonstrations in Britain and lock everybody up that might demonstrate.
Well, also, from Theresa May's point of view, she doesn't necessarily want to be seen to be too close to Trump, although I noticed today, earlier, that Sadiq Khan has said it's good that he's not coming and he's getting the message, and our glorious foreign secretary then went on about, we don't want to mess up the special relationship with the US with some jumped up popinjay who runs London Council, and of course, you know, it's almost like he's addressing the words. He's got no sense of irony, has he, Boris Johnson? You're a plumped-up popinjay, and you're a foreign secretary. And as you can see, people can be mayor of London, and then they can end up involved in international geopolitics.
And what about Trump's alleged comment about Haitians, derogatory comment about Haitians? Because I noticed that, I mean, this story's gone all around the world, but Trump's just saying, well, I never said anything like it. I mean, is this fake news or real?
Well, we don't know, because we weren't there, unless somebody's got a recording of a transcript of it. We're not, you know, this is a reported statement. So, you know, we can take it with a pinch of salt. But I think it's interesting that he picked on Haiti, I think it was, in El Salvador, and went on what SH1T countries these were. That's the allegation. And what makes me snarl with fury, because both countries are a mess because they've been occupied by the United States of America for decades. The first invasion of Haiti by the Americans was in 1915, I think.
So psychologically...
And they're running these
Martin,
countries.
Psychologically, what's going on here? If the president is insulting these countries for being a mess, and yet it's his own administration that over the decades that have made them a mess.
Well, it's the Americans that made those two particular countries a particular mess. They are entirely responsible.
But psychologically,
for the mess in those
what's
countries.
Going on? He seems to be saying the complete opposite of what he should be saying, which is, we're very sorry, Haiti, for making a mess of your country.
Well, no, they don't say that, do they? I mean, it's the narcissism of the US. Trump seems to be and many middle-class Americans seem to be of the view that they're very generous and they try and help everybody and everybody's so ungrateful. But it's an actual fact, the petrodollar system allows the US to live way beyond its means at the expense of the poorest countries on the planet.
Okay.
And it's been functioning like that for decades.
Let's just run through a couple of other stories. The Israelis have approved 1,122 new settlement houses the last couple of days, and WikiLeaks Assange has been granted citizenship of Ecuador after all that time in the embassy. I think he should be given a medal and made the president of the British Association of Publishers or something, since he's probably one of the most well-respected by people around the world, publishers anywhere on the planet, and yet there he is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy still. Also, the Treasury Secretary reckons that there's going to be some more on the Iran sanctions. Apparently, although Donald Trump has signed off this bunch of Iran sanctions, he's waved them through, but it's the last time. Next time there's any kind of question about sanctions on Iran, that's what's going to happen, which is effectively economic warfare on the country.
Well, they've had economic warfare for years, so really what they're talking about is carrying on having sanctions on them. I was reading about the Iranian protests earlier, and it seems pretty clear that they started because of the withdrawal of subsidies for poorer people. And of course they got to withdraw the subsidies because that's part of the deal with the US to try and lift the sanctions, etc.
But they've got these individual sanctions now. Trump is doing this, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page. It's on Zero Hedge tonight. A whole bunch of its specific individuals who are, and they give their passport numbers, who are sanctioned. I mean, they were doing the same with Russia, weren't they?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, they're looking for a fight with the Iranians. The Israelis were pretty clear they want a war with Iran, and they want us to fight it for them. Do the British people want a war with Iran? And if we don't, perhaps we better tell the Foreign Secretary to defend our interests instead of Israel's interests and the US's interests.
OK, well, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi, who's just poking his nose around the door there. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers.
Pacifico Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. This week we bring you an exclusive interview with brilliant film director Fatih Akin, whose latest film, In the Fade, won a Golden Globe Award for Best Foreign Language Film. Akin engages viewers in questions of legal and moral conceptions of truth and justice for immigrants through the prism of a German woman whose Kurdish husband and young son are killed in a neo-Nazi terrorist attack. But first, we put the lens back on the heroic struggle of the working people in Iran by bringing you the second part of our conversation with Professor Aran Keshavarzian. Stay with us. Since December 28th, Iran has been shaken by a wave of protests expanding to far-flung corners of the country, from Mashhad, the second largest city in Iran, to Shahin Shahr in Isfahan province, and to Bukhan in the northwestern region of the country. More than 4,000 people have been arrested, including hundreds of students, unionists, and activists. Here is the second part of a discussion recorded last week between Vomina's Shahram Aghamir and Professor Aran Keshavarzian.
The Official Statistical Center of Iran has reported that at least 14% of the population lives in tents or sheds, as they call them. I also looked at some figures from 3 years ago, which indicated the percentage of people using informal dwellings in some large cities. They were 34% in Mashhad, 31% in Ahvaz, 26% in Iraq, 19% in Hamadan, 15% in Rasht, and 34% in Kermanshah. This is the city which certainly has higher percentage after the earthquake last year. All these cities were involved in the current protest. How well can we claim that we know Iran's urban poor in general and their participation in this protest and other types of collective action?
In terms of actually our knowledge or research on the urban poor, there frankly isn't enough, and we don't have enough research. For Westerners, the sets of questions that are asked have been quite limited and focused on factional politics and the kind of urban elites and political thought and the intelligentsia. So we need a lot more research in general.
The sheer numbers are there, right, based on these figures.
Sure, the sheer numbers are there. I think they're increasingly, or they're very visible to Iranians, as I mentioned, in, whether it's in news reports or just walking down the street and seeing increasing numbers of people, even children, who clearly are living in very dire situations. So poverty is more visible to Iranians, just as extreme wealth is visible. So there's poverty. It's understudied, underappreciated. You take any bus ride or subway ride to various parts of Tehran, and the urban poor are quite visible. So these people are clearly there. And if you don't want to take the bus ride or the walk, you open a newspaper, and there are various ways that the urban poor feature, and that plight, the lack of housing, the types of employment and so forth, is quite there. The more challenging or difficult question is that the protesters today in these streets, or these protesters that have been involved over these last years in various localized forms of dissent, are these groups the same? As I suggested, I actually think your formulation of thinking of these protesters as actually being the middle-class poor, the people that actually have enough money to put into a bank, but yet have so little money that when that bank goes bankrupt, their whole livelihood is destroyed. Or people that have education but don't have the right connections and the job market is such that they can't gain meaningful employment that can cover all of their increasing expenses. So it's this impoverishment of the middle class that I think is driving the protests rather than the abject poor that are, in a sense, they are so poor they don't even receive the limited social welfare that the government provides. The studies that we have on social welfare in Iran, which is significant and laudable in many ways, but much of the social welfare provisions in Iran are directed actually not to the poor, but to the middle class and even the upper middle class. So the subsidy programs, the healthcare benefits and those things, they actually don't go to the poorest segments of Iranian society. So unfortunately, those Iranians, and the statistics that you just read out, are both, in a sense, absent from the protests, I think, or relatively absent. I'm sure there's some that are deeply involved and they're risking their lives about this, but they're relatively absent. But they're also, in a sense, unseen and unimagined by social policy. The measurement of these things gets very complicated. You know, what exactly is the threshold?
Right.
The main point, though, is that the small towns and rural areas outside of the major metropolitan areas have a larger percentage of that population is deeply impoverished. That pattern, you have to grapple with that reality when thinking about why the protests are take place in the locations that they are today rather than in Tehran and Shiraz and Tabriz and so forth.
We have also been hearing slogans, as you mentioned, against the entire ruling bloc and the political elite. Some of the chants are against all factions of the regime, the conservatives, the reformists, as well as the centrists. What are your thoughts on this matter? Does this signal a deep-seated dissatisfaction or disaffection with the reformist faction and possibly a complete break from their agenda? Is this a turning point or is it a watershed moment?
I suspect that you're absolutely right, that this is a very critical juncture for what we've referred to in past years as the reformist movement. It is clear that these protests are not galvanized by the issues of the Green Movement and Mir Hossein Mousavi. It is also clear that for many members of the intelligentsia and the reformist circles, they were taken completely off guard by these protests. That's why for a number of days they had very little to say. Even after they were kind of prodded to make statements, they didn't make any statements or made very lukewarm statements, and in some cases even made statements that parroted some of the lines of the hardliners, that these protesters were instigated by foreign elements in Saudi Arabia and so on and so forth. So there's a real threat that the reformist movements have discredited themselves by both their lack of a response and their kind of highly problematic response, in which they basically, in some cases, responded in very similar ways as the hardliners.
So it almost looks like the regime closed ranks.
Rouhani has tried, in his public statements, he's tried to walk that very fine line by saying that the protesters have the right to express their grievances and the government should listen to these demands, but also underlying and stressing that violence will not be tolerated, the destruction of property will not be tolerated, and so forth. So he's tried to walk this fine line, but the question is, how tenable is this?
Where are the outlets of expression? I mean, there are these groups, in one form or the other, they have tried to have rallies, they have tried to have assemblies. A lot of them are not even given authorization to hold these rallies and so forth. Look at International Workers' Day, May 1st. They would not allow them to go out. They would have to assemble inside a stadium.
One way to respond to these protests is say, look, there are a lot of grievances out there. There are a lot of different segments in Iranian society. We, the government, are going to recognize this diversity of views and opinions and demands of 80 million Iranian citizens. And we're going to do this by acknowledging and licensing independent associations and organizations, issuing licenses for rallies and gatherings and so on and so forth. That way, whether you want to call it cynically and say it was co-opt these protesters or legitimate them, however you want to think of it, this would be a very reasonable response.
Sure.
And to be fair, some members of the reformist bloc have made statements like this. Even a very interesting member of the parliament on Twitter argued for legalizing independent workers' associations and so forth. So that's a very reasonable response. But given that the Islamic Republic and many segments of the Islamic Republic are unwilling to share power and have been unwilling to tolerate dissent, it seems very unlikely that the current elite will make these sorts of gestures to institutionalize avenues of participation. It seems very unlikely that will happen. You know, you raise the reformists, which is it's important to think about them. They obviously are a partner with Rouhani and the current government, but we just passed the 20th anniversary of Khatami's election and the emergence of the reformist movement in the late 1990s. So I think we're in a good position to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses, the contributions and the limitations of the reformist movement at this moment after two decades. And, you know, on the one hand, we can say that they have been important for Iranian society and Iranian politics because they've introduced and emphasized a kind of vocabulary, a discourse about citizenship, about participation and transparency. And all of these concepts and notions actually fit in and even inform the demands of the protesters today in the streets of Iran, the call for the end to corruption, the call for meaningful participation, and the call for social rights and so forth. So the reformist agenda actually can be compatible with the demands today in some ways. And the reformists also demonstrated that they have, you know, very good tactics and methods to ensure large electoral participation and ensure that their candidates can win elections. Been beating the hard line. Whenever the election out participation rates go up, reformist-oriented candidates win. And in the case of Rouhani, he owes his presidency in part due to this alliance with the reformists. So these are the strengths of the reformists. However, throughout these 20 years, they've never really shown any serious interest in organizing at the level of the working class and various working class communities. They've been, you know, frankly, just merely interested in engaging with these communities and these people as potential voters, voters to they could bring out once every 4 years for elections to cast a vote for them, hopefully. And when they were out of office during the Ahmadinejad years, we have very little evidence that they really engaged in any kind of serious self-critique or reevaluation of their economic policies and agendas. And in fact, so the reformists, if they or frankly any other political actor does not develop social roots that would allow for communication with various branches and segments of Iran's lower classes, the working classes, these groups and these parties will never earn the trust of these communities and today's protesters. And if that doesn't happen, we won't have an Iranian political system that will be democratic in any meaningful way. The only way to develop a meaningful democracy, and I would call it, you know, a social democracy, is for these political organizations, whether it's the reformists or any other groups that emerge in the coming years, to actually take the diversity of Iranians and their demands and their aspirations seriously and actually listen to them and respond to them. The other complicating factor to think about is that Iran is at a moment of transition, right? It's clear that the supreme leader is eventually going to have to step down, be replaced, and it's going to happen sometime soon. It is also clear that this whole generation is gradually no longer going to lead this regime. Rafsanjani passed away recently. It is also the second term for Rouhani. So this is his last term in office. So these next few years are years of transition. Partly what I think is complicating things for the political elite is if they do stick their neck out and take a strong position, they may ultimately be sidelined and in a sense have no role and no position during this moment of transition. I mentioned Ahmadinejad a couple times to go back to Ahmadinejad. What is interesting about Ahmadinejad is here's someone who was president for 8 years, from what we understood was the darling of the supreme leader and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, at least in those opening few years, who has been, in a sense, shunted aside by the regime, mm-hmm. who was not allowed to run in the previous election, yet has in these past several months, through various forms of social media and so forth, has been continuously mocking the supreme leader, trying to claim the voice of the disinherited, talking about the corruption of the judiciary, the corruption of the Larijani brothers, and so forth. So he's actually tried to become this independent voice. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that he had did have a social base that allowed him to defeat Rafsanjani for his first term in office, and he did, whatever happened in the 2009 elections, he did have a significant number of votes, and he did have a social base. So he's, in the margins, has tried to cultivate a social base of his own, but in this week, he's actually been completely silent. Now, it's hard to know why and so on and so forth, but I suspect one issue that's crossing his mind as well as others is that this is a very risky time to actually try to carve out a radical position. Because if you do, you could be simply eradicated and you won't be able to be a player during this transitional stage and moment. One thing to look for is, will Rouhani, in a sense, be the pragmatic moderate that he is and try to make piecemeal kind of measures to keep himself relevant as a player and somehow patch together some semblance of a coalition within society? Or will he actually try to engage with and broaden his social base? But in doing that, he's going to have to actually confront and challenge some of the basic authoritarian pillars of the Islamic Republic. That very well could lead to him paying a very serious price. In a sense, Khatami has paid the price by being completely shunted aside officially. And in the comments or lack of comments this past week, he may have lost his social standing as well.
So, Arang, since we brought the concept of class, I would say, back to the heart of our discussion and the heart of this unrest in Iran today, and you talked about the new liberal structure adjustments that began after the war with Iraq ended in 1988, and this has been ongoing irrespectively of who controls different branches of the government or the different branches of the state. And Mr. Rouhani doesn't seem to be an exception to this trend, as you mentioned. Improving the business environment was the key economic point in Mr. Rouhani's program when he was running for the presidency. And this was 5 years ago and hasn't changed. Basically, improving the conditions of the new liberal capitalism that's been governing Iranian economy. The issue of social justice is essentially ignored, as you mentioned. Is there a reason for these protesters to believe that any of these factions within the establishment may have plans to address the grievances of subaltern classes and groups? 6 months ago, the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development admitted that the figure of people living under the poverty line was 33%. That's not abject poverty. And some economists, such as Hossein Rahfar, have argued that this is as high as 40%. Do you see any potential within the ruling bloc, in spite of different factions and so forth, that they have either the capacity or the will to meet these demands?
At this moment, I'm quite pessimistic, both given the issues that I've talked about just now, about the complicated transitional moment that Iran is going through and the tendency of the Iranian elites to be overly pragmatic and overly cautious. So that doesn't bode well. But also, as I mentioned earlier, even if they do have the will, you know, from what we've seen in terms of the ineffective response to environmental and seismic shocks and so on and so forth, at this juncture, I'm quite pessimistic that the Iranian establishment has the will or capacity to implement the necessary reforms that are required to, in a sense, reconstitute a new social contract where it can engage the diversity of its citizens who have very different needs, very different demands, and take them quite seriously. I don't think the state has the machinery to do this. Society, while it is mobilized and deeply politicized at this moment, because the state doesn't recognize independent associational voices, society isn't organized in ways to directly engage with state actors. And frankly, part of the problem that Iran faces, and I would say the whole globe faces, is that we don't have many good, clear models of an alternative to this neoliberal capitalist model that is clearly failing not only Iranians and Egyptians and Tunisians and Turks and what have you, but also failing large numbers of Americans and Germans and Greeks and Latin Americans and so on and so forth. So part of the challenge we all have is that to remember Iranians are struggling in a world that we are also part of, and the challenges of an unaccountable government, the challenges of living in a world where many public assets have been redirected and diverted into private hands, these are all issues that are of concern to people around the world. We have seen in the past decade, since the 2008 recession, and we don't have a very good blueprint of how to get out of this mess. Iranians, whether they're members of the government or not, they face their internal domestic challenges and contradictions, you know, the high expectations that people have of the government, but they also face the challenge of when they look beyond the borders, not only are there not many good models, but they see civil wars, massive destruction of societies, whether it's Syria, Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on and so forth. It's a very, as many people have commented, we're living in dark times, and Iranians are similarly living in these dark times.
When we talk about sanctions that are imposed on Iran, as difficult as they have been for the Iranian society and for the most susceptible or most vulnerable classes in the society, the argument that comes in terms of sanctions is almost as if we go to the times prior to sanctions, things will be okay. But when you look at the trajectory of the Iranian economy, there has been, as you said, the breach of the social contract and the tendency to pauperize the population as a whole. It seems to me the blueprint is not there, as you mentioned.
Blueprint is not there. And the other challenge that specifically the Rouhani administration faces is that this economic model where the goal is to create a climate for investments, both domestic and international, is predicated on foreign governments, and specifically the United States, to allow this to happen. So in the coming days and weeks, one of the issues we also have to follow is, what is the Trump administration going to do? How are they going to respond to both the events inside Iran, as well as their tepid approval support for the nuclear agreement that the Obama administration signed on to and pushed through? At this moment, the Europeans have, however imperfectly, have private companies and governments have engaged with Iran, have invested in Iran. But if the Trump administration decides that it wants to take punitive actions against Iran, one way it could do so is to actually put pressure on European governments as well as firms to stop investing and engaging within Iran. This is a real risk for the Iranian politicians to think through and calculate, and will only worsen the already dire plight that Iranians are facing.
Can you comment on the tweets made by Mr. Trump and the statements by his administration?
It's hard to discuss Donald Trump, you know, other than say that this is his attempt to show that he's a man of action by tweeting. From my perspective, Donald Trump can't do very much. Supports the protesters, these technological policies and so forth, from my perspective, probably won't do much one way or the other. But, you know, he does have the power to destroy the nuclear deal and undermine the ability of companies and governments to invest in Iran,
sure.
which only will deteriorate the situation and escalate the conflict and the violence inside of Iran, right? It would open the door to the Revolutionary Guard and the judiciary to be even more draconian in their arrests. They're already arresting hundreds of people. This would only escalate if they can point and say, look, the U.S. is trying to overthrow the regime. So Donald Trump's power is to be even more is there to be counterproductive rather than to actually be productive.
They may try to level more sanctions against Iran. They may use this as a pretext.
Which is not going to help Iranians trying to demand their rights.
And then sanctions, as we know, and we have seen experiences of in other countries such as Iraq, it only hurts the most vulnerable sectors of society, and it destroys the social fabric of a society.
The issue in the United States is that no politician's ever going to lose any votes for being critical of the Islamic Republic. So for Donald Trump or Democrats, for that matter, it's always easy to admonish the Islamic Republic, and they will continue to do so because there's no real cost in doing this. At the same time, the U.S. government can't really do anything to concretely support these protesters, as far as I can see. There's very little that they can do. I don't know about technology of the internet and social media. Maybe there's some marginal things, but from my perspective, social media may have facilitated these protests, but they weren't essential components of these protests.
But would they even want to support this protest?
I think the U.S. government and many U.S. members of the U.S. establishment would like to appear like they're supporting the protests. You know,
right.
I just want to see Iran weakened.
So it brings up this other question. The Iranian regime has been boasting but the fact that they're on the island of stability in a region that is engulfed in turmoil. Given that, and given their cooperation, if you like, or fighting a common enemy or common foe in Iraq between the United States and Iran, do you really think they would want to destabilize the regime in a way that it would create another chaos inside Iran?
That's a good point. I'm sure in Washington and in the halls of power and think tanks, there are many people who would support, who would be cheering on these protesters, not because they may overthrow the Islamic Republic,
right,
but they will keep the Islamic Republic
contained,
occupied, contained internally, vulnerable, and fragmented.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it plays into their hands. Of course, there are those who want regime change and so on and so forth, but I don't think that's really a viable option and would have massive kind of popular support in the United States. In a sense, this scenario of a weakened, fractured Iran plays into the hands of kind of U.S. geostrategic interests.
The regime has blamed, as usual, has become normative, the regime has blamed outside powers for instigating the unrest in Iran. That sort of rhetoric, as I said, is consistent with how it has reacted in the past to protests in 1999 and 2009. This time, certain elements within the establishments have named the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia as the countries behind what they call quote-unquote sedition.
You know, this was a predictable reaction, also maybe noteworthy or unfortunate that some members of the reformist circles also even turned to foreign forces as an explanation for these protests in some cases. So there's also this somewhat peculiar case of the Telegram application accounts, Ahmad News, that has had virulent kind of anti-regime rhetoric and has been quite popular in Iran, has something in the order of 1 million followers. It was removed and a new one was recreated in its place. And some people are wondering who is behind this, what is behind this, what resources and so on and so forth. So you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to actually wonder about the interests and actions of foreign governments when it comes to internal Iranian events.
We have also been hearing for the past 6 years, since the crisis in Syria evolved into a civil war, there has been this fear roaming around Iran that any serious attempt for a change from below that involves street politics and civil disobedience could lead the country down the path of civil war and disintegration. I mean, it may be reasonable for some ordinary Iranians to have such concerns, but the fear has been systematically propagated and amplified by the ruling bloc inside Iran for the obvious reasons that no change means maintaining the status quo. This kind of a sentiment, this kind of fear, takes the agency away from the people in the streets. What do you make of those fears and those that sort of a rhetoric?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that the ruling bloc is very cynically used the specter of violence in Syria, a violence that they have actively participated and contributed to, but they've used that as an argument for Iranians to remain quiet and remain supportive of the regime and so on and so forth, supportive of the IRGC, for instance, you know, the idea that the IRGC is fighting in Syria or in Iraq.
The Revolutionary Guards.
So, yeah, the Revolutionary Guards is fighting in Syria and in Iraq, so that Iranians won't have to confront ISIS or mayhem inside their own country. This language has permeated the newspapers and the public sphere for almost a decade now. That's just pure cynical politics on the part of the establishment. I do suspect, however, that many ordinary Iranians are concerned that if Iran goes down a revolutionary path, the situation is such that it could very easily spiral into extreme bloodshed, civil war, and foreign countries intervening. For Iranians living in Iran, this is not far-fetched. They look to the east, they see Afghanistan. They look to the west, they see Iraq, they see Syria. They've seen the events in Yemen more recently. So again, for particular social strata, you know, middle-class Iranians, the prospect of war is quite serious. And let's not forget, these are, for many Iranians, they have experienced the tumultuous and painful experience of revolution, as well as 8 years of war with Iraq. In a sense, Iranian society has paid an enormous price for those events. So while the government may be using Syria in a manipulative fashion, I think we should be respectful of Iranians who may genuinely be concerned, you know, of the different strategies one could use to improve one's life, improve one's, the government's performance, responsiveness, and so on and so forth. The issue is that there are multiple forms of politics available to Iranians, whether it's voting or not voting, trying to organize an association or a union, having wildcat protests in the streets, and so on and so forth. So for some Iranians who may be deeply critical of their government, they probably, you know, have a different appraisal of what pathways or what strategies are better or not for getting what they actually want, which is a better life, a more representative, accountable, and just government.
It is difficult, Arang, to see how a protest movement without unified leadership, effective organization, and clearly defined objectives can survive the Iranian regime's coercion. What do you think will happen? Also, what will be the significance of this protest in the struggle for social justice and democratic freedoms in the midterm and long term in Iran?
For the short term, I suspect these protests will peter out. The lack of leadership, the lack of focus is a serious Achilles heel. The inability to date to build bridges to other segments of Iranian society and other parts of Iranian society that haven't taken the streets are a real issue. Of course, everything is quite fluid at this moment. There could be unexpected events, and there could be continuation of these sorts of protests and a shift of these protests to other venues. And so for these protests to gain greater traction, they really do need to build alliances with a broader array of segments of Iranian society. And that's a very difficult challenge in general, but especially under the deeply authoritarian context in which these events are taking place. However, if these protests do kind of peter out and die down, the point I've been trying to make is that the forces and the factors that have generated this form of anger on the part of many Iranian citizens, these factors have not gone away and are deeply complex and are deep and profound challenges for Iran's polity to grapple with. So just even if next week there are no longer people on the streets, it doesn't mean that these issues will not deeply affect decision makers and policymakers in Tehran, as well as the way Iranians look at each other and the society that they live in. These protests are unexpected in terms of their scale, but are deeply connected to both the legacies of the 1979 revolution, as well as a distinct pattern of social justice protests and demands of the past two decades.
Arang Keshavarzian is an associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at New York University and the author of Bazaar and State in Iran, Politics of the Tehran Marketplace. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir from New York. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Director Fatih Akin's new award-winning film, In the Fade, tells the story of Katja, a blonde German woman played by Diane Kruger, whose life falls apart after her Kurdish husband Nuri and her six-year-old son Rocco are killed in a targeted bomb attack carried out by a young neo-Nazi couple. She's devastated by the loss and decides to pursue legal action. And when the judicial system fails her, she decides to take matters into her own hands. Mr. Akin first wrote a draft for the film as a teenager in 1992 to help process the racism and dangerous nationalism Germany was experiencing during the unification after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In a recent interview with Dateline, he said, "I could have been targeted just because of the way I looked, just because my parents were Turkish. That really upset me." In The Fade, Fatih Akin explores notions of truth and justice, both in the legal and in the moral sense, and how contradictory and flexible these concepts can be.
You have to know that racism, especially in Germany, because I live there, because it's my home, bothers me or concerns me all my life. Since I was like 10 years or 12 years old, and I heard about skinheads in Germany who were killing Turkish people just because they're Turkish. I heard first about this in 1986. I was 12 then, when a group of neo-Nazis killed a Turkish immigrant in Hamburg. And for a child, this is like a shock, trauma. The place where you felt is your home, where you felt you are protected, is not just protecting you. You have to take care. And since then, it was always something which made me concerned and think about. In the 90s, when the two Germanys came together, East and West Germany, the falling down of the wall, it was like immediately a rise of an extreme nationalism in Germany. So on the one hand, there was a patriotism, and on the other, there was like this extreme nationalistic thoughts which broke out because of it was not allowed in Germany to be too patriotic or too nationalistic, because this is the heritage of the Second World War in Germany, you know?
Mm.
And suddenly the German flag was everywhere. And today it's normal because of the football, and today it's not disturbing anymore, besides like certain left groups, you know. But at that time in the 90s, it was something which really scared you to see everywhere the German flags. That was not something which I knew from my youth before, you know. Mm. And with that rise of nationalist extremism, there were killings. The extremists were looking for targets. The reunion also created losers, of the economic losers of the society, and they were found very fast. This was like the Turkish immigrants, and they were burning people, you know. Yeah. They were throwing Molotov cocktails in Turkish houses back in 92 and 93. These were like the killings of Mölln and Zuling. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, I was an angry young man. I just started studying film, or I wanted to study film, so I started to write a story about it, which was a very different story than in The Fade, but it has like the same motivation, you can say. I have to express myself. I need a catharsis by writing this. And I want to make audience in Germany aware that this is really like existing, and to see it like from an immigrant's perspective.
Fatih, there have been many, many cases of neo-Nazis and fascists attacking immigrants in Germany.
Yes.
However, there was a huge case of another gang of neo-Nazis going on a killing spree of Turks.
Yes, it was Turks and Kurdish families, mm, and one Greek person who was married to a German, and one German police officer.
And yes,
we call them the NSU killings. Yes. They stand for like National Socialistic Underground. This was a terror group where we know in public they were based on three people, but nobody knows how many there really were, how much connections they had, if they had connections to the Secret Service. There are certain connections where it seemed to be like the Secret Service at least was knowing about them when nobody else knew about them, but they were hiding their information. The scandal of the NSU killings was not that this terror group of three people killed these immigrants and the police officer between 2000 and 2007. The real scandal was nobody knew who killed these immigrants. And very fast, the police, the investigators, the media, and the society claimed the murderers must be searched in the families of the victims itself.
Mm.
because they're Turkish, because they're Kurdish, they must have been involved in criminal activities. This is a racism, a hidden racism, but it is there. And so even the liberal press was not really investigation for evidences, was not really listening to the victims.
And this went on for several years.
Yes, this goes on from until 2011. And in 2011, by an accident, it came out that the killers were Nazis. The accident was the National Socialistic Underground was financing themselves by bank robberies. And the two men were doing the bank robberies, and the woman, Beate Zschäpe, was organizing them. The two men, Uwe Bernhard and Uwe Mundlos, they were doing a bank robbery, and they get almost caught. They were involved in a shooting with the police, and then they killed each other. But there is not a real evidence that they really killed each other. We don't know if they were killed or if they killed each other. It looks like they did suicide. And then Beate Zschäpe, the woman Nazi, she went to the police and gave up. And that was the real scandal, that in all these years between 2000 and 2011, we were, I say we because we Germans, we blame the victims itself. The second killing.
That also comes out in your film, In the Fade. So let's talk about all these issues that you brought up, which racism, hatred, and I'm going to add terror as well, which they have inflicted on immigrants community, on Turkish, Kurdish communities for many years. In the Fade is a story of Katja, a white, blonde German woman played by Diane Kruger,
yes,
who's devastated after her Kurdish husband, Nuri, and her six-year-old son, Rocco, are killed in a targeted bomb attack. The attackers end up being a young neo-Nazi couple.
Yeah.
She's devastated by the loss, but she wants to pursue legal action. She's looking for justice. The justice system fails to convict these new Nazi killers, and then she's forced to find other ways. You tackle so many topical, universal, and German-focused issues in this film. The violence by new Nazi extremists, the racism by the police, and even Katja's mother, who questions her about marrying Nuri, a Kurdish man who she basically questions her. Did you know what kind of a person you were marrying or who you were marrying? And the connection between the new Nazi couple and the new Nazi organization Golden Dawn in Greece. The core of your film is about how one seeks justice and what happens to victims. But you also tackle some real issues. So there are so many complex layers at work in your film. Everybody focuses on the new Nazi couple and the relationship between Katja and the couple. But there's so much more in this film that you haven't been asked about.
A lot of these elements in the film are based on true events. But I didn't make the film about the true events, you know, because somehow the true events are the true events, and I didn't want to do a documentary. I wanted to fictionize it, and on the same time, using the fiction for, like, my own thoughts into it. So therefore, fiction can have a catharsis, and I'm not speaking about the revenge as the catharsis thing, mm-hmm. You know. It's when I created the biography of Katja, and I created the biography of the neo-Nazis, they came from the same place in Germany. Mm-hmm. They're both from northern Germany. They come maybe even from similar houses, like backgrounds. That was an opportunity to show the neo-Nazis of today, they doesn't automatically have to be children of Nazis. They can be children of the liberal, which is in the film, in the Fade, the case. The father of the neo-Nazi is a liberal person. Since this war of cultures is existing, and I'm not talking about the Middle Eastern world and the Western world. This is not what I'm talking about. I mean the culture between the liberal elite of a society in the West and the majority who doesn't belong to the elite. I don't want to use the term like not educated, you know, but like less educated or taking less care of education. There's a worldwide gap between those. Politicians in the West belong to the liberal societies, mostly those who are ruling in Germany, pre-Trump America was like that. Somehow the elites missed the contact to a majority in the folk who feel themselves as losers. Losers of the, or marginalized of the globalization. Losers of education. People who don't want other people to tell them what they should eat or what they should wear, which car they should drive. This is a worldwide conflict. And certain politicians, reactionary or charismatic figures who came out with the only target to have power, to have money, are very using their charismatic to use the fears of the public. They can use it with the tools of the social media, very easy.
And also use the liberal electoral system to gain power, as, for example, the right-wing Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, campaigned on a xenophobic and anti-immigrant platform, and they won some 100 seats in the parliament.
13% in the last election.
Yes, which is huge. When we're talking about neo-Nazis, it's also about these fascist tendencies that can lead to violence, but at the same time, it can exist in the society and it could be practiced in other forms. As you have said in some interviews, they beat up immigrants. They even beat up some Germans who support immigrants. That's what happened to one of the mayors in a city that was pro-Syrian immigrants.
The reality gives so many hints which was worth and like focused on. You know, for example, the Greek Golden Dawn, who is appearing in the film as witnesses. This was based on the protocols of the real trial, of the NSU trial, which is still going on. I read all the protocols of 4 years. We're now in the 5th year. I don't read them anymore because once I start doing the film, you know, and the screenplay, I was not following the protocols anymore. But before that, I read them all. And they were mentioned like observers from the Golden Dawn or neo-Nazis, German neo-Nazis with the Golden Dawn T-shirts were sitting and observing the trial. I researched about the network. It's really shocking how much these groups are connected worldwide. You know, they are connected in Europe, but what happened in Charlottesville, the right-wing movement there in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis were there, they're definitely connected with neo-Nazis in Germany and England. So the film gave an opportunity for the audience to inform themselves more about this. I tackle these things, but I go on with my story. The most complex thing in this is casting it with a German person. That was very, very, very important. Some people think I did this to reach a wider audience, you know, to have a German star, a worldwide star in that, you know, which is absolutely not...
You're talking about Diane Kruger's character, who was the main
character. The character Diane Kruger is representing in the film, that she is German. Yesterday I had a Q&A at the USC in Los Angeles, and there were some German students. They were kind of like angry and shocked and crying because I said, I wrote this character because it was very important for the German Germans, for the white Germans, for the elite, if you want, not to feel safe once the hero has, I don't know, a Turkish or a Muslim background.
That would have been too easy to...
Too easy, too safe. Yeah. You are not involved in what you see. And me as an immigrant who faced racism in Germany, I'm involved in it anyway. I will not get more involved if it is a Turkish origin heroine.
I thought you were implying that Germans need to look at the mirror and look at themselves.
Right.
And see how they have also allowed for the rise and perpetuation, a wave of racism and fascism with the history that Germany has, especially given now that these new Nazi groups have become part of the political system.
Yes.
And basically you were offering the German society two choices. You either become Kacho, you can live with a Kurdish man, not a perfect man, but a loving man in a loving family, or you can become part of this cycle of violence, hatred, and terror.
I think there's more in between than just these two extremes, but what is in between often is in movement, is still not complete. You know what I mean? The rise of the AfD, to mention, it's not just a party of neo-Nazis, but neo-Nazis feel themselves home in that party because they share some certain targets. One of the targets is the protecting the German culture, whatever that means. The protecting of the blood, if you want. This is one of the programs of the AfD. The protecting of blood, not mixing of blood. You can protect it with demonstrations, with political agendas, but there is another group who doesn't want to mix this blood, who wants to protect the blood, but they go one step farther. Protecting the blood means terminating the other blood. Mm. And these were the Nazis, and they feel home in the AfD. And the AfD doesn't succeed to create a gap, a bound, like, okay, here is a limit. We don't want to go for termination. They never say something like that, you see? Because they're also dealing with other issues, with the euro, with the kindergarten, and all these kind of stuff, you know. The people were not racist, you know, but like the losers of the globalization, they feel a home in this group. Will be left out, and some of them are left out, and they come from other political backgrounds. Some of them come from the left party, from the Linke, and some of them come, believe it or not, from the Social Democrats. They were disappointed from the Social Democrats because the idea of social justice is more and more difficult to present and to sell and to fight for. So people who feel like if the Social Democrats cannot protect social justice, they go to an extreme party like the AfD, and there they get in touch with neo-Nazi ideologies. And this is the danger. And this is what the film tackles, I tell you.
As I said, this woman wants justice.
Yes.
And she does not get it from the legal system.
Yes.
And she does take matters into her own hands. In an interview with Tagesspiegel newspaper, you spoke about the notions of truth and justice in your film, both in the legal and in the moral sense, and about how contradictory and flexible these concepts could be.
This is the story of mankind. It really is. This is a story of evolution, if you want. This is a story of the limits of globalization. So, for example, we in Germany, we don't have the death penalty. But here in the United States, you have it. Not in each state, but in many states. You have it in California. You have the death penalty. In Turkey, you don't have the death penalty anymore since 2002 or 2001, since Erdogan took over. But now they're speaking about to bring the death penalty back in the game. Mm. So what does it mean? It means different times and different societies have a very different opinion about justice and about moral. There is not this one justice, this one moral, which is concrete.
But issues of morality, justice, in some ways you're talking about them and you're tackling them through the perspective of the victim.
Yes.
What does justice mean for the victim? What is her truth? What is the best moral decision she can make in order to seek justice? So these are from the point of view of the victim, not the victimizer.
If I would be a victim, if I would have a loss like Katya in my life, this is a pain which would never be healed. So now comes the legal system in Germany. The legal system in Germany has a persecutor, you know? So the state is represented by the persecutor, but the persecutor is not representing me as a victim. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So I have a lawyer who is representing me, but he just can act in the spaces of the legal system of the constitution or where the legal system is made. And I definitely believe that my emotional want and need, speaking as a scriptwriter, would be fulfilled in the bureaucracy of legal system or in the defender of the state. I would not be represented by this emotionally. I know there is a conflict in here, which is very interesting, also very disturbing, and the decision Katja takes is not politically correct. But the liberal press in Germany, the critics, more film critics than like the political writers, the film critics, a lot of them are astonishingly very moral with what Katya is doing towards the end. They really argue with morality in this, and they're not aware to consider this as art. And Heinrich Böll, the German writer who just came on that the other day, he said once something like, the task of art is always also to go too far in a society that we understand where are the limits and the boundaries of the society. This is very important.
Fateh Akin is the director of the new film In the Fade, which has won a host of awards internationally, including the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film. Diane Kruger has also won the Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival for her role in the film. In the Fade opens in Berkeley, San Francisco, and San Rafael on Friday, January 12th. For more information, visit inthefadefilm.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com, connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Where are the people in the nuclear age? Norma Field. In the annals of nuclear accidents, Fukushima has a special place. In Chernobyl, the government opted to remove the 116,000 people living around the power plant. In Fukushima, there's an ongoing effort to remove the contamination and to bring the 154,000 evacuees back. The Japanese government claims the effort is successful. Independent researchers have serious doubts. As of the end of 2017, there are 30 million bags of radioactive waste collected from houses and roads throughout Fukushima Prefecture. Each bag weighs 1 ton, and while waiting to be processed, the plastic tears, and strange trees are growing out of the bags. Admittedly, the cleanup so far only reached 5% of Fukushima province, and the only peer-reviewed data on the status come from independent researchers. They find that contamination returned to cleanup areas via wind, rain, and traffic. That includes radioactive particles of uranium, thorium, radium, cesium, strontium, polonium, tellurium, and americium. Norma Field is an author and professor emeritus of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. She has taught pre-modern Japanese poetry and prose and gender studies. She's a frequent visitor to Japan, where she was born in 1947. Norma Field and Arne Gundersen spoke in Chicago at the beginning of December 2017 to express their concern about the unquestioned celebration of the first nuclear chain reaction. It was set in motion in Chicago Pile 1 by Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago 75 years earlier. The nuclear industry and nuclear weapons interests had rushed to Chicago in 2017 to report on their plans for future weapons production and more nuclear power stations. Norma Field spoke for NEIS on December 2nd, 2017. The Nuclear Energy Information Service had invited her and Arne Gundersen to call attention to the plight of people who suffer the consequences of radiation. Norma Field.
I've been thinking again about nuclear weapons rather more than I'm accustomed to lately. I've been thinking much more about nuclear reactors, but it's been very salutary in reminding me that these technologies cannot be separated, and they're played off against each other to justify each. What are nuclear weapons? What's their justification? Obviously, to protect a country against an external enemy. What about nuclear power? It's supposed to bring prosperity to local and regional communities, right? That's what justifies these two. And then thirdly, which is something I won't talk about very much, medicine, diagnosis, and therapy. There was a wonderful moment yesterday when the moderator asked very innocently of the two doctor researchers who were on the nuclear medicine panel, is nuclear medicine related to weapons and defense? And the response that came out was, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. I will say just, you know, I would not hesitate to get radiation therapy or use diagnostic or whatever tools for myself or people I care about or any human being who needs it at the moment. At the same time, the bland defense of it, like I can imagine medicine finally becoming what justifies both the above two. If the first two become too risky in the social psyche. Okay. So science, it's summoned all the time in Japan, but it happened in Chernobyl, and it happened in the American Southwest, too, and elsewhere. Science is used to claim that health effects are mostly in your head, right? And it's called radiophobia. Some people call it nuclear phobia. That worrying about radiation is worse for you than the actual effects can be. Now, that should never, ever be substituted for the actual injuries that they have been and continue to suffer. But when science is summoned like that, it is horrendous. I'll quote Timothy Mousseau, great evolutionary biologist who's worked on the barn swallow in Chernobyl and also has been working in Fukushima too. One thing he will say is that the barn swallow does not suffer from radiophobia. So if changes appear in the barn swallow's body, it must be real in some way and rather than psychic. Well, maybe if we could get therapists for barn swallows, we would find out that Tim is wrong. But in any case. And the other worst thing, I think, science goes one step further in Fukushima, and I'll get back to this later, I hope, is that one of the lasting legacies of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs is discrimination against the victims. So the victims are at least twice victimized. They've had the bombs inflicted on them, and then they have to worry about their children and grandchildren suffering from discrimination in marriage and employment. And this immediately became a hot topic in Fukushima after the disaster. We hear about cars with Fukushima plates being trashed, parents trying to get their children to boarding schools outside at a very early age. This is not a common practice in Japan because they want their children to break any bureaucratic record of their children's ties to Fukushima. canceled early on so that they won't suffer. So one of the things science has begun to say is, if you continue to be unscientific and keep expressing your worries about health and about the safety of our food products, you're just inviting discrimination against Fukushima, right? Think about your fellow Fukushima citizens and stop talking about worries. You can imagine what kind of pressure this creates on people living in Fukushima who might be worried too. This is slightly different, but the whole issue of progress, right? It struck me listening to a group of ethicists, esteemed ethicists at the University of Chicago Divinity School, you know, posing this question ponderously: do you ever want to stop science's search for truth? This is very commonplace. It's not just ethicists at the University of Chicago Div School who pose that question. There's something we consider sacred about the scientist's mission. We don't remember that the scientific truths that get found out are usually, now more than ever, scientific truths that have been funded, that have had funding to get there, and that there are many truths that scientists are not able to uncover because they don't have the funding to do it. That's another issue with Fukushima too. So there's that, but there's that kind of sanctity of the scientific mission. I kept hearing that in the background over the University of Chicago commemoration, that this was great science. This is what science was able to discover. And then on a technological level, right, we can produce smaller, more portable nuclear weapons. We can produce small modular reactors, small, portable, safer, so forth and so on. And I think that technological discourse relies tacitly on the sanctity given to scientific knowledge and exploration, and I find it really annoying and dangerous. I should say that part of the motivation for me in doing this work comes from a friend and colleague I had at the University of Chicago, no longer with us. She was a Hanford downwinder who died of a cancer in her mid-40s. But anyway, a useful map, although no map is complete. It shows areas of the United States crossed by two or more clouds during atmospheric tests in Nevada, 51 to 62. And we should learn to read this map, envisioning Nevada test site workers, atomic veterans, downwinders, as we know, who would include many, many Native Americans. We have to note that up in the Northwest, Hanford in Washington State, maybe the worst clean-up site, not clean-upable site in the United States, which manufactured the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb. You can't tell the harm that was taking place there, nor can you tell the harm taking place in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. I just read, some of you that may have read the news report this week of Eniwetok Atoll, which was one of the places terribly contaminated. And now they're getting a double whammy after having been returned there, having the atoll declared safe for return. Now the rising sea waters will probably make their home disappear, and it has tons and tons of waste irresponsibly dumped there by the United States. And also, I have to say, these are all testing sites, human radiation testing sites for the United States. And one of the things said about the Marshall Islanders early on, it's a secret project 4.1, was a government official saying of Marshall Islanders, they're not civilized like white people, but, quote, they are more like us than mice. Marshall Islanders are more like us than mice, so it's still worthwhile testing them because that result will get us closer to what's happening to truly civilized white people. All right, now I want to get right straight to the University of Chicago here. Ed Markey, right, name many of you will recognize, currently senator from Massachusetts. This is a report that came out in 1986 to the House subcommittee that then Congressperson Markey chaired. I think the title captures it. I mean, we're so unused to hearing honest words spoken out of our Congress that this title, American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, 3 decades of radiation experiments on U.S. citizens, is fantastic. That's exactly what it is. It covers about 31 tests including 699, about 700 people. What is important about this, the University of Chicago comes up about 6 or 7 times in this, along with other institutions like UC Berkeley, UC San Francisco, MIT, labs like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge. Oh, they're doing things like injecting plutonium into terminally ill patients, except that some of them turn out not to be so terminal. They live on for 20 years. I don't know what happened to them, but I can't help thinking that people who were already ill, who don't die from getting plutonium injected into them, but continue to live 20 years, might not have exactly had a robust 20 years to live on. And we don't learn these things from these reports. But a report that particularly caught my eyes, not because it's worse than anything else that we see there, like Marshall Islanders, that doesn't show up at all, is one involving University of Chicago students and staff. 1961 to 63, 102 students and staff were fed actual pieces of Nevada test site fallout or simulated pieces of test site fallout. They were getting worried about all those above-ground tests and where's that fallout going since we have a lot of people there. And you need to find out how these radioactive substances pass through the body. So have them ingest it, eat it, in some cases solution, so drink it, and then see what comes out of the body. They also know that not all of it comes out, and they also knew then that internalizing radioactivity is actually more harmful than merely external exposure. I was shocked yesterday at the University of Chicago panel to hear one of the doctor scientists say, the old thing, you've heard it, flying from X to Y is more harmful to you than any radiation you might be exposed to on the ground. Just kept giving these examples of external exposure as if that were the sum of it. Shouldn't scientists be embarrassed to pass off such information, as facts? Okay, many of you may have seen pictures of American soldiers, atomic veterans, they're called out to witness nuclear explosions. Again, interest in seeing what this stuff does to the human body. Soldiers are very convenient. It's only in the Gulf War that I learned that when you join the Army, you give up a lot of your human rights. You're tested with injections that the FDA hasn't approved yet, et cetera, et cetera. Well, these soldiers' well-being obviously was not being looked after. How many soldiers were exposed in this way? I'm particularly pleased to have found this because this is soldiers watching the explosion of Small Boy. And as you'll see in the text on the right, the actual fallout that was fed University of Chicago students and staff was from Small Boy. I would love to get the survivors in the left hand and the survivors in the right hand together. I don't know, is there a hashtag that would make them recognize themselves? If you think of one, let me know, because they deserve to know and they deserve to meet each other. They really do, and this should be part of any institution, not just the University of Chicago, reflecting back on this era. Okay, this is a contrast that's often drawn by Japanese activists, that whereas in the former Soviet Union, human beings were moved away from the most contaminated place, in Japan, you keep them on site, and you do what is called decontamination. And most of us now say this is manipulation, deceptive manipulation. All they're doing is moving pollution. Because what are you going to do about this mountainous prefecture, precipitation, etc.? But some of you will immediately think, but the former Soviet Union was huge, right? They had all, and also it was a socialist economy, granted. But one of the things that's been a big topic in Japan for decades now is rural depopulation. There are these limit communities where young people don't exist. It's very hard. There are a lot of rural areas that Fukushima farmers could have been assisted to move to, for instance. And in any case, what's going on is extraordinary criminal. It's just criminal. I love Arnie's picture of the decontamination bags because it had a tree growing out of it. Let me contextualize this in a different way. It's really hard if you don't go to places that had the earthquake and the tsunami, it's hard to show the damage done to Fukushima by the nuclear disaster. Why? Because radiation's invisible, right? If you're not showing the plant, you're not showing things like the bags. In fact, I had a friend who asked me last year, she said, Norm, I have a bunch of people coming to Fukushima City, and I'm supposed to give them a tour, and I don't know what to show them. And I said, right, you've got to tell them that the minute they get to the station. Tell them it's really hard for me to show you the harm. There's a place in Fukushima City up a hill, so concealed, right? Fukushima City, let's remember, is the prefectural seat of government. It's where the bullet train stops. No way the government was going to evacuate Fukushima City, although it has numerous hot spots. And then there are Olympic fields, too. They're bags, but they're on a hilltop, so they can't be seen from below. There are these monitoring posts. The monitoring posts, which are rigged anyway, you know, they might have lit around the bases. Or there was one company that produced a first set of monitoring posts to show the airborne radiation, and it seemed to measure too accurately, so the prefecture commissioned another company. So in many places, oddly enough, you will see two posts side by side, one of which isn't the needle's not moving. Anyway, but even that's kind of iffy. So the point now that there's an effort to remove them. And sometimes the citizens who still have the energy will protest the removal of a monitoring post from their community. But this is one place where we can see the harm. Volume reduction facility. There are a bunch of these that have been built at huge cost. Huge cost. These are temporary facilities. You can imagine that having all those bags around is not good in the recovery campaign, right? And so you have to do something about them. And this is one of the solutions, a volume reduction facility. Arnie can tell us more about how helpful these things are. First of all, by reducing the volume or concentrating the radioactivity. And these things are releasing all the time necessarily as part of their operation. And think of what is under the facility in the ground once it's shut up. Oddly enough, I've seen two of these facilities right near the community graveyards, the cemeteries. And they want to warn people who are coming to the graves of their family members not to light incense because the air is so dry and might set off a fire. So, and guess what? Your thoughts sincerely sent out will reach your dead loved ones. So don't feel like you have to literally light an incense. And this one, sweetly enough, is from the Village Women Firefighters Association. So that kind of, oh, I don't know, bureaucratic tragicomedy. There's evidence of that everywhere. The schools are intent on giving children the proper knowledge about radioactivity, right? For very young children, I went to one of the huge, you know, multi-million, if not billion-dollar complexes with some facilities are for some parts of the facility for research, others for community events. There's a place where you can leave your kids. There are tatami mat rooms, really cozy, kind of sterile, but kind of cozy. Nice space. And then they had a huge screen. And the screen is teaching very young children, preschool children, about alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays. And everybody knows papers, rocks, scissors, right? The children are taught to, as the alpha particle shows up, if you can put out your two fingers, you can conquer that alpha particle with scissors. And beta might be rock, and gamma rays, paper. Anyway, and then there's a sweet young woman there, and there you have the kids. I got one picture with kids and a mother and the woman to encourage them, and they're kind of all bopping around the screen. And say, moms, you're not doing as good, well as your kids. Come on, let's get in the action. Right, early on, show your children that radioactivity is not to be feared. All right. Thyroid cancer. Pediatric thyroid cancer. You may have heard that there are extraordinary levels of pediatric, youth and pediatric thyroid cancer in Japan. And there are, because up to now it's been considered a very rare form of cancer for children, for this population. Thyroid cancer is on the rise around the world, I have read. But right now, what is it, 193 cases confirmed or suspected. By suspected only means that the children have not had surgery yet, and therefore, without analyzing of the organs, they can't say definitively. Probably that is not the complete picture. However, some of you might even remember the heralded Professor Jerry Thomas, one of the scientists in favor of nuclear, saying right after the Fukushima disaster, thyroid cancer is one of the best cancers you can get. And say that to people having a hard time with their hormones after thyroid removal. But anyway, because you catch it and it's out and no problems. However, one thing that Fukushima is teaching people, and I don't see enough written on this in English, that thyroid cancer in children and youth seems to move much faster than in adults. And so while the authorities or medical authorities are busily touting the screening effect that, oh, you know, the Soviets, they didn't have the accurate instruments. We have too many accurate instruments being an advanced country, and that's why we're diagnosing cancers that should just be watched, if anything, that are never going to cause trouble to these kids. In fact, the Prefectural Medical Association, Pediatric Association last year was proposing that coming up with so many cases of child and youth cancers is causing what? Guess what? Anxiety, stress among the people of Fukushima. It is not beneficial to the people of Fukushima. Therefore, we should start scaling down the screening, right? But the people involved in this, the brave people, one of the scientists who was involved in the parliamentary committee to study the is a champion of this for these children and their families, are saying, no, this is not the screening effect, because we have found among the children and youth who've had surgery, distant metastasis, for example, recurrence. No, we need to be doing this more widely, because the plume didn't stop, the iodine didn't stop, the radioactive iodine did not stop at prefectural borders. But only in Fukushima can you get the screening examination. We should be examining it and more fully, and we should be paying attention. We need to catch these cases early. All right, my theme right now is about the difficulty of making radiation harm visible. So 2016, I thought this was amazing. This was dubbed as the coming out of thyroid cancer families of children. So by children and youth, I mean that the survey began with those who were 18 and under and living in Fukushima at the time. So it was a coming out of these families. Again, remember, we're worried about discrimination. And so that's one of the big snags, and what will surely become more and more urgent is to guarantee free health care for people who experience this, as happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Again, the great worry about being known as having a cancer in your family has kept everyone anonymous and isolated and stressed out. You know, it's another source of stress in families. I read a really painful one of an interview, no names, where a middle school-age son had to have surgery. And whom did he blame? His mother. Said, "You made me with this defective body." Right? This is the kind of a structure that will make the most vulnerable turn against each other. So they will be too preoccupied speaking truth to power. Anyway, so I was really looking forward to this press conference, and this is what happened. These are the reporters in a room in Tokyo, and two fathers appeared, and they were speaking from Fukushima. And this was their coming out. Showed only the trunks of their bodies. Their voices were altered so they couldn't be identified. In other words, It's as if they who might make visible evidence of Fukushima health harm had to be made invisible in a way, right? You see, it just keeps on turning on itself and not working to help the people who need the help. And moreover, hiding their faces as if they were criminals, as if they are injuring society, and in a certain logic in Fukushima, don't talk about harm in Fukushima. We're getting the Olympics. The Olympics signals our recovery. It's carrot and stick. I don't know how it actually works as a carrot, but certainly a huge stick. Don't you dare say or do anything that suggests it's not safe to be living here. So this is what I come back to. Who is protected by nuclear weapons? Who's the enemy? And who's made prosperous by nuclear power? Okay, thank you.
That was Norma Field, advocating for people in the nuclear age. She's an author and professor emeritus of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. She spoke for NEIS on December 2, 2017. The Nuclear Energy Information Service invited her to Chicago to counterbalance the celebration of the first nuclear chain reaction that made nuclear weapons and nuclear power possible. And thanks to Dale Lehman from WZRD for this recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This program is presented in honor of my mother, Lillian Brown Vogel, whose vivacious 39,549 days finally caught up with her on December 29, 2017. She died at her home here in Ukiah, California, surrounded by her family at the age of 108. Smiling until she closed her eyes for the last time, she cherished her well-lived life, as do I. I dedicate this program to everyone who seeks to lead a long, active, and happy life. My mother played the piano almost daily for 104 years. She voted in every election since 1930, declaring herself a feminist from some of her earliest days. In 1930, she began medical school. She earned a master's degree in 1933 and a PhD in 1961 when she was 51 years old, both in psychology. She worked as a clinical psychologist, retiring in 2005 at the age of 96. In response to many queries about the secret of her long life, she published her memoir, What's My Secret? 100 Years of Memories and Reflections, on her 100th birthday in 2009. My mother was driven by her curiosity and her joy of life. She was able to get to the heart of most any matter with a few simple questions, and then always wanted to know more. This interview, originally recorded on Halloween 2009, was poetically updated by her, as you'll hear, on September 9th, 2014, and begins when I asked her, "Mother dear, what makes you so curious?"
Well, it's just that I've always been interested in people. I wondered if they had the same kind of questions in their mind that I had in mine. I was just curious.
just about a half a century ago, you received a PhD in psychology. Before then and since then, you've had a fairly extensive experience in observing people and talking to people. What answers have you learned to your wonderment about, do other people have the same questions as you?
I think they probably do. I think that they too wonder what their life is about and what they can do with their lives to make it better. They would come to me in a professional way because they were unhappy. And my job would be to help them become aware of the fact that they could be happier, that there are many ways in life that one can become happy.
So in doing your job, if there's a generic question or questions, what would those questions be that you would ask the people who come to you?
Do you ever look at yourself as to help yourself determine what do you do that contributes to these feelings of discomfort that you have? Is it always the other person, or is there something within you that you would like to understand, and apparently you don't? That's why you're here, or to discuss with me, what can I do to help you?
In your book, What's My Secret, I know that working with you since before you began working on this project, you said that people asked you, what's your secret? So the answer is in your book, What's My Secret? Do you deal with the issues and the questions that you just posed to your patients and clients who have come to visit with you over the years in answering What's My Secret?
I don't think I did specifically in that way. I wasn't always as old as I am now. And when I was young, I wasn't asked that question.
So the answer, what is your secret?
I would say it involves many factors. Dealing with the psychological, I think that I have utilized what I've read about and thought about and become aware of the power within me as well as within other individuals to direct my thinking in ways that will help me overcome stress, which I've encountered in various ways throughout my life.
When you say the power that is within each of us, tell us about that power.
That power is an ability to control our thinking. When we feel depressed, there are hormones created in the brain which somehow travel down into the digestive area, which eventually gets to the circulatory system and other parts of the body. It originates in the brain. It originates in the way one thinks. I believe that we have the power within limits to direct this thinking, to direct the quality of the thinking.
You're aware of that. I'm aware of that, perhaps by osmosis and the good fortune of having been your son for many years. But how can other people become aware of that power that we each carry within us?
That's a good question. I don't know that I can give a specific answer to anyone else, but I can write as I have written what's happened to me in my life. And in stressful situations that I have encountered and that I have somehow learned to deal with. Now, where did I learn it? I probably learned it through books that I read, through courses that I took, and applied this to my own life experience. So how can this help others?
Well, my question is, how can you phrase it or ask it so that other people can become aware of this ability? Positive psychology, as I've heard you call it.
I can explain to them that they have this power, that they can direct their thinking. When you're feeling very depressed, and often when people feel depressed, they lay it upon others. Others, you've done this to me. And by thinking it through, you can say, well, perhaps someone else did. contribute to your feeling of your negative feelings. But it's how you accept these negative feelings, how you interpret it, that you have the power of doing this.
Can you give us some examples?
Well,
your life, the lives of others that you know about?
Well, in the lives of others, it would be a more complete life history, which we don't want to go into now. I am thinking of myself. There's an incident that I describe in the book of when we had been in a hotel in San Francisco, and coming home, I discovered that I had lost my earpiece, which is very helpful to me at this period of my life. And I began hunting in the car and in my purse and where I was sitting and so on. There was no sign of it. And I immediately began condemning myself for having lost this. How could I be so stupid? I ought to know better than to not check and make sure that I had my hearing aid when we left the hotel. Well, this went on all the way home, and when I got home, I had difficulty falling asleep. In large part, it was self-condemnation that was going on, that I should know better. I should check when I leave the hotel to make sure that I have everything that I brought in with me. And then I woke up during the night and realized that this was really going to make me feel pretty bad the next day, because I became aware that I had insurance that would cover a large part of the loss and so on. As it turned out, this hearing aid was found by the attendant in the hotel and mailed to us the following day. But that was incidental. What mattered was the unhappy thoughts that I had and the self-condemnation that I was experiencing during this episode. And when I woke during the night and realized that this was really pretty stupid, because all this self-condemnation was getting me nowhere, it almost seemed like I had a turnabout. And I decided, okay, well, there is insurance, that's what it's for, and so on. And the thoughts became more positive. And this feeling of condemning myself for being so stupid and careless kind of faded away.
I remember another episode in your life before you moved to Ukiah. In your office building in Encino, part of Los Angeles, there was somebody who I think was in the process of committing a robbery of you and other people. And there's a story that you told me that I hope you can retell now about how you turned your ring around on your finger.
That was an incident of a meeting. We were in a building in Los Angeles, carrying on whatever the business of the meeting was. And suddenly the door opened, and there were two young men that came in and asked everyone there to empty their pockets and empty their purse, which everyone did and threw into the middle of the floor. And then one of the fellows walked around and was going to remove rings, obviously hoping he'd get a diamond. And I remember I had the ability to turn my ring around. It happened to be a diamond engagement ring. I turned it around, and when he looked at my hand this way, he could see only the part of the ring without the stone in it. As he looked at my other hand, I twisted it around and showed him again that it was blank. I haven't thought about that incident for years.
But that's not a personal condemnation. It's quick thinking.
It was quick thinking put into action. But I obviously didn't want this ring to be taken.
So what is the suggestion that you might have for someone who's in a tight situation where they have an instant to quickly think, to save something that's important? I remember when you told me that story, it was about staying calm in a crisis.
Interesting. I haven't thought of that for years. That's what I did, though.
Lillian Brown Vogel is the author of What's My Secret? 100 Years of Memories and Reflections, her memoir, published in 2009 on her 100th birthday, when this program was originally recorded. This wonderful woman was my mother. She died on December 29th, 2017. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
Well, let's change gears here for a minute, Mother, and talk a little bit about some of the issues in your book. And the two that I'd like you to tell us about are the two that I hear from you more frequently now. One is loneliness, and one is resilience.
Well, I think that I've been plagued with loneliness on and off since your dad died, because as I mentioned in the book, I had never been alone in my life before. I was alone, but there was always somebody coming home shortly. When I got married, I left my mother's house, and so I wasn't alone then. And I was 20 years old when that occurred. But more recently in my life here in Ukiah, even though most aspects of my life here has been more than favorable, there have been many moments when I'm alone. And it's something that I have been struggling with, I would say. I came across some writing by Mary Sarton, a woman who had experienced loneliness and wrote a lot about it. And she said that loneliness is the emptiness of the soul, but solitude is an enrichment of the soul. And I put a lot of thought into that. And I have been dealing with these thoughts, I would say, on and off since I've been living in Ukiah.
How do you deal with it?
Well, specifically, I have many sources of activity that interest me. I play the piano. I always have a lot of reading matter around. I always had my cat, who would cuddle up and sit in my lap and so on.
Maybe we could talk about Rosie. Rosie, your cat, came to the end of her days just a few days ago. And I know when we were driving over here to the studio, you were talking about grieving. Tell us about that, about grieving a lost love.
Even as you ask me that, I am overcome with sadness, because this little kitten I had had for almost 15 years.
I remember you got her shortly after Mortimer died.
That's right.
My father.
And I brought her here with me to Ukiah. And she's always been very close. She slept on my bed. She has come over and licked my hand. Or when I'm sitting on the couch, she'll come and sit on my lap and so on. I've always been attached to her. She wasn't a particularly beautiful cat, just a little ordinary black cat with half a tail. Her tail had been caught in the door when she was very young. So I've just been dealing with it even currently. There's more to say. I have a bowl in the bathroom that I used to fill with flowers, just a small round bowl. And Rosie got to drinking water out of that bowl. So I decided then, well, this would be her water hole. So we always kept it filled with water, and she would always come in the bathroom and get her water there. Well, since I had disposed of her in the last week, which I did with a lot of trepidation, I refilled that bowl and found a beautiful rose outside and put a rose into the bowl. And now the last few days as I walk by, I smile when I see the rose in the water, which reminds me of all the nice little things that Rosie did for me. So I've decided that was a very constructive little act. I wasn't even aware that it was making that much of an impression on me.
As I remember, having learned from you, maybe you can tell the story of why she was named Rosie.
Oh, she was named Rosie because your dad was very fond of roses.
As am I.
And cultivated roses.
As
and
do
that's,
I.
And that's why, that's right. And that's why I named her Rosie. But just today, before I came over here, I walked past the open bathroom door, and here was this round bowl with a beautiful rose in it. And I smiled instead of feeling depressed as I had been.
So that comes to the other significant part in your book, What's My Secret? And that's resilience.
Now, I would regard my situation with Rosie in the last few days as one of stress. And stress is very wearing on the body. Resilience is being able to leave the stress here and rise above it. And I think that just this process which hit me of putting the rose into the bowl again and seeing the beauty of Rosie rather than the sadness of her in her last days and so on was helping me to become resilient. Because I walk by the open door and smile now. Hello, Rosie, is what I said just this afternoon.
And that's what you said when you would come home and
yeah.
see her in the same tone of voice.
That's right. I really hadn't connected it all together, but I'm putting it together right now.
So to a larger group, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning and your curiosity about other people, do they have the same concerns and questions that you do in your studies over the years? Do you have any suggestions about how people can become resilient at a time of stress?
We have to think of a stressful situation that after a period of time, one can direct one's thinking by saying to oneself, this isn't doing any good. There may be ways that I can direct my efforts that will give me happier memories, new memories that will help me deal with this situation. So what I'm referring to is what we call cognitive thinking. I'm referring to the fact that we as each individual have the power to control our thoughts. And when one is in a period of stress, you can't immediately turn it around, but you can deal with it and begin to think of what you can do in a positive way. Now, this is directing one's thinking. What can I do in a positive way that will maybe reduce the stress and unhappiness I feel now, but in a positive way, help me remember the positive aspects of what occurred.
With the goal orientation of dispelling the unhappiness associated with the loss, before we end, two questions. One is there a concept or an idea or a philosophy that you live by or that you've learned recently that you can tell us about?
I think it would involve several items. One of them would be dealing with stress, which I've gone into a little in greater detail. And not to feel self-condemning if you're in a stressful situation and you don't immediately get out of it. You don't have to get out of it immediately. But at any rate, when you do get out of it, there are other aspects of life that are much happier to think about. For example, laughter is a very positive aspect of living. Laughter does something to all the hormones, to put it simply, all the hormones in the body. And a good laugh shakes you up, your chest and your back muscles. Laughter often results in a feeling of happiness. Even by thinking about it, you can twist it around and make it laughable, make it funny. Not at anyone's expense, but just the situation may be funny. That's a positive. In another sense, when you feel like you've been, mistreated, not physically, but in some psychological way you've been slighted and so on, and your feelings are hurt. One way that makes me laugh for anyone who would do it is to immediately get on the phone and return insult with insult. But I would say this should never be done. It's something that one should speculate about and think, if I call this person and tell them off, so to speak, obviously it won't make you feel better and it won't make the other person feel better. So let it rest for a bit and come back to it a bit later with a different perspective. So I would say that's something that's helpful. At least it is to me.
Well, I'm pleased that we've had this conversation. And before we close, Mother, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, the book is a story. It's a true story of a family traveling from the east going to the west coast. And they were attacked by Indians. And the parents were killed. And two daughters were taken by the Mojave Indians. The older daughter did live with the Indians for about 4 years. And obviously the Mojave Indians were very kind to her. And she related to them. Subsequently, some white travelers were aware that there was a young Indian girl who by this time was about 17. The younger sister had passed away because she wasn't well. And they rescued the older daughter. She retained a love for the Mojaves. It was an interesting book from the psychological aspect of she had lost her own parents and was transferred into a totally different culture and was able to adapt.
Well, Mother, I'm honored. I'm honored to be your son, and I'm honored to have you on Radio Curious. Lillian Brown Vogel, author of What's My Secret? Memories and Reflections on a Long Life, and my dear mother, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much. It's been indeed been a pleasure.
On September 9th, 2014, my mother and I met for lunch at her home to review the plans for her upcoming 105th birthday celebration on September 11th. When I explained that Radio Curious would feature our 2009 conversation, which you just heard, she offered to read the poem from the conclusion of her book, What's My Secret?
My enlightenment. Days roll on, and soon the years. My own little world full of wonder and joy. Anger about unhappy events. What lies ahead? Thrust into sadness at times, so severe that the joys of life are no longer here. To believe that to start again can never occur. And then the light. It can occur. To go on again as a part of this wonderful earth with its scientific advances, the sounds of music, the laughter of children, the beauties of nature, and its reflection in art. Can all this crowd out ghastly sights of people at war? Can I bury my head or see only beauty, closing my eyes to the cruelties of mankind as we destroy each other and this amazing earth? Yes, I must do both. To believe we are here for reasons unbeknownst, yet for love and happiness of all. So my remaining years on this wonderful earth shall be wholeheartedly treasured as I enjoy the wonders and fight injustice. All this concomitantly.
Are there any other thoughts that you would like to say less than 48 hours before you're 105 years old?
I would say how wonderful these almost 20 years have been living in Ukiah. I have to say that I love Ukiah. I have met wonderful people, all of you included, and I have derived great satisfaction. Not enough to satisfy me, though. I don't feel that I've done enough with my life, so I have lots of, should I say, sad feelings that I could have done more if I had more organized ambition. All right, so where do I go now?
Where would you like to go if you could go anywhere in the whole world or the whole universe?
On my chair and take a snooze.
This program was presented in honor of my mother, Lillian Brown Vogel, whose 39,549 days of vibrant life finally caught up with her on December 29, 2017. A few days before she died at the age of 108 years in her home here in Ukiah, California, she asked a dear friend who was one of her many beloved caregivers, "Will you be okay when I'm on my merry way?" The book Lillian Brown Vogel recommended in 2009 is The Black Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman by Margot Mifflin. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.